Needful Things by Stephen King. You've been here before. Sure you have. Sure. I never forget a face. Come on over here. Let me shake your hand. Tell you something. I recognized you by the way you walked even before I saw your face good. You couldn't have picked a better day to come back to Castle Rock. Ain't she a corker? Hunting season will be starting up soon. Fools out in the woods banging away at anything that moves and don't wear blaze orange. And then comes the snow and sleet, but all that's for later. Right now it's October, and in the Rock we let October stay just as long as she wants to. As far as I'm concerned, it's the best time of year. Spring's nice here, but I'll take October over May every time. Western Maine's a part of the state that's mostly forgotten once the summer has run away and all those people with their cottages on the lake and up on the view have gone back to New York and Massachusetts. People here watch them come and go every year. Hello, hello, hello. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. It's good when they come because they bring their city dollars, but it's good when they go because they bring their city aggravations, too. It's aggravations I mostly want to talk about. Can you sit a spell with me? Over here on the steps of the bandstand will be fine. The sun's warm, and from here, spang in the middle of the town common, we can see just about all the downtown. You want to mind the splinters, that's all. The steps need to be sanded off and then repainted. It's Hugh Priest's job, but Hugh ain't got round to it yet. He drinks, you know. 'Tain't much of a secret. Secrets can and are kept in Castle Rock, but you have to work mighty hard to do it, and it's been a long time since Hugh Priest and hard work was on what you might call good terms. What was that? Oh, that! Say, boy, ain't that a piece of work? Them flyers is up all over town. I think Wanda Hemphill, her husband Don, runs Hemphill's Market. Put most of them up all by herself. Pull it off the post and hand it to me. Don't be shy. No one's got any business sticking up flyers on the town common bandstand in the first place. Hot damn! Just look at this thing, will ya? Dice and the Devil, printed right up at the top, in big red letters, with smoke coming off 'em, like these things was mailed special delivery from Tophet. Ha ha! Ah, someone who didn't know what a sleepy little place this town is would think we're really going to the dogs, I guess. But you know how things sometimes get blown out of proportion in a town this size. And the Reverend Willie's got a bee under his blanket for sure this time. No question about it. Churches in small towns. Well, I guess I don't have to tell you how that is. They get along with each other. Sorta. But they ain't never really happy with each other. Everything will go along peaceful for a while, and then a squabble will break out. Pretty big squabble this time, though, and a lot of hard feelings. The Catholics, you see, are planning something they call Casino Night at the Knights of Columbus Hall on the other side of town. Last Friday of the month, I understand, with the profits to help pay for repairs on the church roof. That's Our Lady of Serene Waters. You must have passed it on your way into town if you came by way of Castle View. Pretty little church, ain't it? Casino Night was Father Brigham's idea, but the Daughters of Isabella are the ones who really picked up the ball and ran with it. Betsy Vigue in particular. I think she likes the idea of dolling up in her slinkiest black dress and dealing blackjack or spinning a roulette wheel and saying, "Place your bets, ladies and gentlemen. Please place your bets." Oh, but they all kind of like the idea, I guess. It's only nickel-dime stuff, harmless, but it seems a wee bit wicked to them just the same. Except it don't seem harmless to Reverend Willie, and it seems a lot more than a wee bit wicked to him and his congregation. He's actually the Reverend William Rose, and he ain't never liked Father Brigham much, nor does the father have much use for him. In fact, it was Father Brigham who started calling Reverend Rose Steamboat Willie, and the Reverend Willie knows it. Sparks has flown between those two particular witch doctors before, but this Casino Night business is a little more than just sparks. I guess you could call it a brush fire. When Willie heard that the Catholics meant to spend the night gambling at the KSC Hall, he just about hit the roof with the top of his pointy little head. He paid for those Dyson the Devil flyers out of his own pocket, and Wanda Hemphill and her sewing circle buddies put 'em up everywhere. Since then, the only place the Catholics and the Baptists talk to each other is in the letters column of our little weekly paper, where they rave and rant and tell each other they're going to hell. Look it down there, you'll see what I mean. That's Nan Roberts, who just came out of the bank. She owns Nan's Luncheonette, and I guess she's just about the richest person in town now that old Pop Merrill's gone to his eternal rest. Also, she'd been a Baptist since Hector was a pup. And coming the other way is Big Al Gendron. He's so Catholic he makes the Pope look kosher, and his best friend is Irish Johnny Brigham. Now, watch close. See their noses go up? Ha! Ain't that a sketch? I'll bet you dollars to donuts that the temperature dropped 20 degrees when they passed each other by. It's like my mother used to say, people have more fun than anybody, except for horses, and they can't. Now, look it over there. See that sheriff's cruiser parked by the curb near the video shop? That's John LaPointe inside. He's supposed to be keeping an eye out for speeders. Downtown's a go-slow zone, you know, especially when school lets out. But if you shade your eyes and look close, you'll see that what he's really doing is staring at a picture he took out of his wallet. I can't see it from here, but I know what it is just as well as I know my mother's maiden name. That's the snapshot Andy Clutterbuck took of John and Sally Ratcliffe at the Freiburg State Fair just about a year ago. John's got his arm around her in that picture, and she's holding a stuffed bear he won for her in the shooting gallery, and they both look so happy they just about spit. But that was then, and this is now, as they say. These days, Sally is engaged to Lester Pratt, the high school phys ed coach. He's a true blue Baptist, just like herself. John hasn't gotten over the shock of losing her yet. See him fetch that sigh? He's worked himself into a pretty good case of the blues. Only a man who's still in love, or thinks he is, can fetch a sigh that deep. Trouble and aggravation's mostly made up of ordinary things. Do you ever notice that? Undramatic things. Let me give you for instance. Do you see the fella just going up the courthouse steps? No, not the man in the suit. That's Dan Keaton. He's our head selectman. I mean the other one, the black guy in the work fatigues. That's Eddie Warburton, the night shift janitor at the municipal building. Keep your eye on him for a few seconds and watch what he does. There. See him pause on the top step and look up street? I'll bet you more dollars to more donuts that he's looking at the Sunoco station. The Sunoco's owned and operated by Sonny Jacket, and there's been bad blood between the two of them ever since Eddie took his car there 2 years ago to get the drivetrain looked at. I remember that car quite well. It was a Honda Civic, nothing special about it, except it was special to Eddie because it was the first and only brand new car he'd ever owned in his life. And Sonny not only did a bad job, he overcharged for it in the bargain. Well, that's Eddie's side of the story. Warburton's just using his color to see if he can beat me out of the repair bill. That's Sonny's side of the story. You know how it goes, don't you? Well, so Sonny Jacket took Eddie Warburton to small claims court, and there was some shouting first in the courtroom and then in the hall outside. Eddie said Sonny called him a stupid nigger, and Sonny said, well, I didn't call him a nigger, but the rest is true enough. In the end, neither of them was satisfied. Judge made Eddie cough up $50, which Eddie said was $50 too much, and Sonny said wasn't anywhere near enough. Then, the next thing you know, there was an electrical fire in Eddie's new car, and the way it ended up was Eddie's Civic went off to the junkyard out on Town Road Number 5, and now Eddie's driving an 89 Oldsmobile, which blows oil. Eddie has never quite gotten over the idea that Sonny Jacket knows a lot more about that electrical fire than he's ever told. Boy, people have more fun than anybody except horses, and they can't. Ain't it all just about more than you can take on a hot day? Oh, it's just small-town life, though. Call it Peyton Place, or Twin Peaks, or Castle Rock. It's just folks eating pie and drinking coffee and talking about each other behind the hands. There's Slopey Dodd, all by his lonesome because the other kids make fun of his stutter. There's Myrtle Keaton, and if she looks a little lonely and bewildered, as if she's not really sure where she is or what's going on, it's because her husband, fella you just saw coming up the courthouse steps behind Eddie, hasn't seen himself for the last 6 months or so. See how puffy her eyes are? I think she's been crying, or not sleeping well, or both. Don't you? And there goes Lenore Potter. looking like she just stepped out of a bandbox. Going to the Weston Auto, no doubt, to see if her special organic fertilizer came in yet. That woman has got more kinds of flowers growing around her house than Catter has liver pills. Awful proud of 'em she is. She ain't a great favorite with the ladies of this town. They think she's snooty with her flowers and her mood beads and her $70 Boston perms. They think she's snooty, and I'll tell you a secret, since we're just sitting here side by side on this splintery bandstand step. I think they're right. All ordinary enough, I guess you'd say, but not all our troubles in Castle Rock are ordinary. I got to set you straight on that. No one has forgotten Frank Dodd, the crossing guard who went crazy here 12 years ago and killed those women. And they haven't forgotten the dog, either. The one that came down with rabies and killed Joe Camba and the old rummy down the road from him. The dog killed good old Sheriff George Bannerman, too. Alan Pangborn is doing that job these days, and he's a good man, but he won't never stack up to Big George in the eyes of the town. Wasn't nothing ordinary about what happened to Reginald Pop Merrill, either. Pop was the old miser who used to run the town junk shop. The Emporium Glorium, it was called, stood right where that vacant lot is across the street. The place burned down a while ago, but there are people in town who saw it, claim they did anyway, who'll tell you after a few beers down at the Mellow Tiger that it was a lot more than a simple fire that destroyed the Emporium Glorium and took Pop Merrill's life. His nephew Ace says something spooky happened to his uncle before that fire, something like on the Twilight Zone. Of course, Ace wasn't even around when his uncle bit the dust. He was finishing a 4-year stretch in Shawshank Prison for breaking and entering in the nighttime. People always knew Ace Merrill would come to a bad end. When he was in school, he was one of the worst bullies this town has ever seen. There must have been 100 kids who crossed to the far side of the street when they saw Ace coming toward him, with the buckles and zippers on his motorcycle jacket jingling, and the cleats on his engineer boots clocking away on the sidewalk. Yet people believe him, you know. Maybe there really was something strange about what happened to Pop that day, or maybe it's just more talk in Nan's over those cups of coffee and slabs of apple pie. It's the same here as where you grew up, most likely. People getting head up over religion. People carrying torches. People carrying secrets. People carrying grudges. And even a spooky story every now and then, like what might or might not have happened on the day Pop died in his junk shop, just to liven up the occasional dull day. Castle Rock is still a pretty nice place to live and grow, as the sign you see when you come into town says. The sun shines pretty on the lake and on the leaves of the trees, and on a clear day you can see all the way into Vermont from the top of Castle View. The summer people argue over the Sunday newspapers, and there's the occasional fight in the parking lot of the Mellow Tiger on Friday or Saturday night, sometimes both. But the summer people always go home, and the fights always end. The Rock has always been one of the good places, and when people get scratchy, you know what we say? We say, he'll get over it, or she'll get over it. Henry Beaufort, for instance, is sick of Hugh Priest kicking the Rock over when he's drunk, but Henry will get over it. Wilma Jurzik and Nettie Cobb are mad at each other, but Nettie will get over it, probably, and being mad's just a way of life for Wilma. Sheriff Pangborn still mourning his wife and younger child who died untimely, and it was a sure enough tragedy, but he'll get over it in time. Polly Chalmers' arthritis isn't getting better. In fact, it's getting worse a little at a time, and she may not get over it, but she'll learn to live with it. Millions have. We bump up against each other every now and then, but mostly things go along all right. Or always have, until now. But I have to tell you a real secret, my friend. It's mostly why I called you over here once I saw you were back in town. I think trouble, real trouble, is on its way. I smell it just over the horizon, like an out-of-season storm full of lightning. The argument between the Baptists and the Catholics over casino night, the kids who tease poor Slopey about his stutter, John LaPointe's torch, Sheriff Pangborn's grief, I think those things are going to look like pretty small potatoes next to what's coming. See that building across Main Street? The one three doors up from the vacant lot where the Emporium Galorium used to stand? Got a green canopy in front of it? Yep, that's the one. The windows are all soaped over because it's not quite open yet. Needful things, the sign says. Now just what the dog does that mean? I don't know either. But that's where that bad feeling seems to come from. Right there. Look up the street one more time. You see that boy, don't you? The one who's walking his bike and looks like he's having the sweetest daydream any boy ever had? Keep your eye on him, friend. I think he's the one who's going to get it started. No, I told you, I don't know what. Not exactly. But watch that kid. And stick around town for a little while, would you? Things just feel wrong. And if something happens, it might be just as well if there was a witness. I know that kid, the one who's pushing his bike. Maybe you do, too. Name's Brian something. His dad installs siding and doors over in Oxford or South Paris, I think. Keep an eye on him, I tell you. Keep an eye on everything. You've been here before, but things are about to change. I know it. I feel it. There's a storm on the way. In a small town, the opening of a new store is big news. It wasn't as big a deal to Brian Rusk as it was to some, his mother, for instance. He had heard her discussing it. He wasn't supposed to call it gossiping, she had told him, because gossiping was a dirty habit and she didn't do it. At some length on the telephone with her best friend, Myra Evans, over the last month or so. The first workman had arrived at the old building, which had last housed Western Maine Realty and Insurance, right around the time school let in again, and they had been busily at work ever since. Not that anyone had much idea what they were up to in there. Their first act had been to put in a large display window, and their second had been to soap it opaque. 2 weeks ago, a sign had appeared in the doorway, hung on a string over a plastic see-through suction cup. "Opening soon," the sign read. Needful things. A new kind of store. You won't believe your eyes. It'll be just another antique shop, Brian's mother said to Myra. Cora Rusk had been reclining on the sofa at the time, holding the telephone with one hand and eating chocolate-covered cherries with the other while she watched Santa Barbara on TV. Just another antique shop with a lot of phony early American furniture and moldy old crank telephones. You wait and see. That had been shortly after the new display window had been first installed and then soaped over, and his mother spoke with such assurance that Brian should have felt sure the subject was closed. Only, with his mother, no subject ever seemed to be completely closed. Her speculations and suppositions seemed as endless as the problems of the characters on Santa Barbara and General Hospital. Last week, the first line of the sign hanging in the door was changed to read, "Grand opening, October 9th. Bring your friends." Brian was not as interested in the new store as his mother and some of the teachers. He had heard them talking about it in the teacher's room at Castle Rock Middle School when it was his turn to be office mailman. But he was 11, and a healthy 11-year-old boy is interested in anything new. Besides, the name of the place fascinated him. Needful things. What exactly did that mean? He had read the changed first line last Tuesday on his way home from school. Tuesday afternoons were his late days. Brian had been born with a hare lip, and although it had been surgically corrected when he was 7, he still had to go to speech therapy. He maintained stoutly to everyone who asked that he hated this, but he did not. He was deeply and hopelessly in love with Miss Ratcliffe, and he waited all week for his special ed class to come around. The Tuesday school day seemed to last 1,000 years, and he always spent the last 2 hours of it with pleasant butterflies in his stomach. There were only 4 other kids in the class, and none of them came from Brian's end of town. He was glad. After an hour in the same room with Miss Ratcliffe, he felt too exalted for company. He liked to make his way home slowly in the late afternoon, usually pushing his bike instead of riding it, dreaming of her as yellow and gold leaves fell around him in the slanting bars of October sunlight. His way took him along the two-block section of Main Street across from the town common, and on the day he saw the sign announcing the grand opening, he had pushed his nose up to the glass of the door, hoping to see what had replaced the stodgy desks and industrial yellow walls of the departed Western Maine realtors and insurance agents. His curiosity was defeated. A shade had been installed and was pulled all the way down. Brian saw nothing but his own reflected face and cupped hands. On Friday the 4th, there had been an ad for the new store in Castle Rock's weekly newspaper, The Call. The ad was surrounded by a ruffled border, and below the printed matter was a drawing of angels standing back to back and blowing long trumpets. Aside from the opening time, 10 o'clock a.m., the ad said nothing that could not be read on the sign dangling from the suction cup. The name of the store was Needful Things. It would open for business at 10 o'clock in the morning on October 9th, and, of course, you won't believe your eyes. There was not the slightest hint of what goods the proprietor or proprietors of Needful Things intended to dispense. This seemed to irritate Cora Rusk a great deal, enough anyway for her to put in a rare Saturday morning call to Myra. "I'll believe my eyes, all right," she said, "when I see those spool beds that are supposed to be 200 years old but have Rochester, New York, stamped on the frames for anybody who cares to bend down their heads and look under the bedspread flounces to see. I'll believe my eyes just fine." Myra said something. Cora listened, fishing Planters peanuts out of the can by ones and twos and munching them rapidly. Brian and his little brother, Sean, sat on the living room floor watching cartoons on TV. Sean was completely immersed in the world of the Smurfs, and Brian was not totally uninvolved with that community of small blue people, but he kept one ear cocked toward the conversation. "Right," Cora Rusk had exclaimed with even more assurance and emphasis than usual, as Myra made some particularly trenchant point. "High prices and moldy antique telephones." Yesterday, Monday, Brian had ridden through downtown right after school with two or three friends. They were across the street from the new shop, and he saw that during the day someone had put up a dark green awning, written across the front in white letters with the words Needful Things. Polly Chalmers, the lady who ran the sewing shop, was standing out on the sidewalk, hands on her admirably slim hips, looking at the awning with an expression that seemed to be equally puzzled and admiring. Brian, who knew a bit about awnings, admired it himself. It was the only real awning on Main Street, and it gave the new store its own special look. The word sophisticated was not a part of his working vocabulary, but he knew at once there was no other shop in Castle Rock which looked like this. The awning made it look like a store you might see in a television show. The Western Auto across the street looked dowdy and countrified by comparison. When he got home, his mother was on the sofa, watching Santa Barbara, eating a Little Debbie cream pie and drinking Diet Coke. His mother always drank diet soda while she watched the afternoon shows. Brian was not sure why, considering what she was using it to wash down, but thought it would probably be dangerous to ask. It might even get her shouting at him, and when his mother started shouting, it was wise to seek shelter. "Hey, Ma," he said, throwing his books on the counter and getting the milk out of the refrigerator. "Guess what? There's an awning on the new store." "Who's yawning?" her voice drifted out of the living room. He poured his milk and came into the doorway. "Awning," he said, "on the new store, down street." She sat up, found the remote control, and pushed the mute button. On the screen, Al and Corrine went on talking over their Santa Barbara problems in their favorite Santa Barbara restaurant, but now only a lip reader could have told exactly what those problems were. "What?" she said. "That Needful Things place?" "Uh-huh," he said, and drank some milk. "Don't slurp," she said, tucking the rest of her snack into her mouth. "It sounds gruesome. How many times have I told you that?" "About as many times as you've told me not to talk with my mouth full," Brian thought, but said nothing. He had learned verbal restraint at an early age. "Sorry, Mom." "What kind of awning?" "Green one. Pressed or aluminum?" Brian, whose father was a siding salesman for the Dick Perry Siding and Door Company in South Paris, knew exactly what she was talking about, but if it had been that kind of awning, he hardly would have noticed it. Aluminum and pressed metal awnings were a dime a dozen. Half the homes in the Rock had them sticking out over their windows. "Neither one," he said. "It's cloth. Canvas, I think. It sticks out so there's shade right underneath, and round like this." He curved his hands, carefully so as not to spill his milk, in a semicircle. "The name is printed on the end. It's most sincerely awesome." "Well, I'll be butched!" This was the phrase with which Cora most commonly expressed excitement or exasperation. Brian took a cautious step backward, in case it should be the latter. "What do you think it is, Ma? A restaurant, maybe?" "I don't know," she said, and reached for the princess phone on the end table. She had to move Squeebles, the cat, the TV guide, and a quart of Diet Coke to get it, but it sounds sneaky. "Mom, what does needful things mean? Is it like..." "Don't bother me now, Brian. Mummy's busy. There are devil dogs in the bread box if you want one. Just one, though, or you'll spoil your supper." She was already dialing Myra, and they were soon discussing the green awning with great enthusiasm. Brian, who didn't want a devil dog, he loved his ma a great deal, but sometimes watching her eat took away his appetite, sat down at the kitchen table, opened his math book, and started to do the assigned problems. He was a bright, conscientious boy, and his math was the only homework he hadn't finished at school. As he methodically moved decimal points and then divided, he listened to his mother's end of the conversation. She was again telling Myra that soon they would have another store selling stinky old perfume bottles and pictures of someone's dead relatives, and it was really a shame the way these things came and went. There were just too many people out there, Cora said, whose motto in life was take the money and run. When she spoke of the awning, she sounded as if someone had deliberately set out to offend her and had succeeded splendidly at the task. "I think she thinks someone was supposed to tell her," Brian had thought as his pencil moved sturdily along, carrying down and rounding off. Yeah, that was it. She was curious, that was number one, and she was pissed off. That was number two. The combination was just about killing her. Well, she would find out soon enough. When she did, maybe she would let him in on the big secret. And if she was too busy, he could get it just by listening in on one of her afternoon conversations with Myra. But, as it turned out, Brian found out quite a lot about needful things before his mother, or Myra, or anyone else in Castle Rock. He hardly rode his bike at all on his way home from school on the afternoon before Needful Things was scheduled to open. He was lost in a warm daydream which would not have passed his lips had he been coaxed with hot coals or bristly tarantula spiders, where he asked Miss Radcliffe to go with him to the Castle County Fair, and she agreed. "Thank you, Brian," Miss Radcliffe says, and Brian sees little tears of gratitude in the corners of her blue eyes, eyes so dark in color that they look almost stormy. "I've been, well, very sad lately. You see, I've lost my love." "I'll help you forget him," Brian says, his voice tough and tender at the same time. "If you'll call me Bri."
"Thank you," she whispers, and then, leaning close enough so he can smell her perfume, a dreamy scent of wildflowers, she says, "Thank you, Bri. And since, for tonight at least, we will be girl and boy instead of teacher and student, you may call me Sally." He takes her hands, looks into her eyes.
"I'm not just a kid," he says. "I can help you forget him, Sally."
She seems almost hypnotized by this unexpected understanding, this unexpected manliness. He may only be 11, she thinks, but he is more of a man than Lester ever was. Her hands tighten on his. Their faces draw closer. Closer. "No," she murmurs, and now her eyes are so wide and so close that he seems almost to drown in them. "You mustn't, Bri. It's wrong."
"It's right, baby," he says, and presses his lips to hers. She draws away after a few moments and whispers tenderly, "Hey, kid, watch out where the fuck you're going!"
Jerked out of his daydream, Brian saw that he had just walked in front of Hugh Priest's pickup truck. "Sorry, Mr. Priest," he said, blushing madly. Hugh Priest was nobody to get mad at you. He worked for the Public Works Department and was reputed to have the worst temper in Castle Rock. Brian watched him narrowly. If he started to get out of his truck, Brian planned to jump on his bike and be gone down Main Street at roughly the speed of light. He had no interest in spending the next month or so in the hospital just because he'd been daydreaming about going to the county fair with Miss Ratcliffe. But Hugh Priest had a bottle of beer in the fork of his legs, Hank Williams Jr. was on the radio singing high and pressurized, and it was all just a little too comfy for anything so radical as beating the shit out of a little kid on Tuesday afternoon. "You want to keep your eyes open," he said, taking a pull from the neck of his bottle and looking at Brian balefully, "because next time I won't bother to stop. I'll just run you down in the road. Make you squeak, little buddy." He put the truck in gear and drove off. Brian felt an insane and mercifully brief urge to scream, "Well, I'll be butched!" after him. He waited until the Orange Road Crew truck had turned off onto Linden Street and then went on his way. The daydream about Miss Ratcliffe, alas, was spoiled for the day. Hugh Priest had let in reality again. Miss Ratcliffe hadn't had a fight with her fiancé, Lester Pratt. She was still wearing her small diamond engagement ring and was still driving his blue Mustang while she waited for her own car to come back from the shop. Brian had seen Miss Ratcliffe and Mr. Pratt only last evening stapling those Dice and the Devil posters to the telephone poles on Lower Main Street along with a bunch of other people. They had been singing hymns. The only thing was, the Catholics went around as soon as they were done and took them down again. It was pretty funny in a way. But if he had been bigger, Brian would have tried his best to protect any posters Miss Ratcliffe put up with her hallowed hands. Brian thought of her dark blue eyes, her long dancer's legs, and felt the same glum amazement he always felt when he realized that, come January, she intended to change Sally Ratcliffe, which was lovely, to Sally Pratt, which sounded to Brian like a fat lady falling down a short, hard flight of stairs. Well, he thought, fetching the other curb and starting slowly down Main Street, maybe she'll change her mind. It's not impossible. Or maybe Lester Pratt will get in a car accident or come down with a brain tumor or something like that. It might even turn out that he's a dope addict. Miss Ratcliffe would never marry a dope addict. Such thoughts offered Brian a bizarre sort of comfort, but they did not change the fact that Hugh Priest had aborted the daydream just short of its apogee, kissing Miss Ratcliffe and actually touching her right breast while they were in the tunnel of love at the fair. It was a pretty wild idea anyway, an 11-year-old kid taking a teacher to the county fair. Miss Ratcliffe was pretty, but she was also old. She had told the speech kids once that she would be 24 in November. So Brian carefully refolded his daydream along its creases, as a man will carefully fold a well-read and much-valued document, and tucked it on the shelf at the back of his mind where it belonged. He prepared to mount his bike and pedal the rest of the way home. But he was passing the new shop at just that moment, and the sign in the doorway caught his eye. Something about it had changed. He stopped his bike to look at it. "Grand opening, October 9th. Bring your friends." At the top was gone. It had been replaced by a small square sign, red letters on a white background. "Open," it said. And "open" was all it said. Brian stood with his bike between his legs, looking at this, and his heart began to beat a little faster. "You're not going in there, are you?" he asked himself. "I mean, even if it really is opening a day early, you're not going in there, right?" "Why not?" he answered himself. "Well, because the window's still soaked over. The shade on the door is still drawn. You go in there, anything could happen to you. Anything." "Sure, like the guy who runs it is Norman Bates or something. He dresses up in his mother's clothes and stabs his customers." "Right." "Well, forget it," the timid part of his mind said, although that part sounded as if it already knew it and lost. "There's something funny about it." But then Brian thought of telling his mother, just saying nonchalantly, "By the way, Ma, you know that new store, Needful Things? Well, it opened a day early. I went in and took a look around." She'd push the mute button on the remote control in a hurry then. You better believe it. She'd want to hear all about it. This thought was too much for Brian. He put down his bike's kickstand and passed slowly into the shade of the awning. It felt at least 10 degrees cooler beneath its canopy and approached the door of Needful Things. As he put his hand on the big, old-fashioned brass doorknob, it occurred to him that the sign must be a mistake. It had probably been sitting there just inside the door for tomorrow, and someone had put it up by accident. He couldn't hear a single sound from behind the drawn shade. The place had a deserted feel. But since he had come this far, he tried the knob, and it turned easily under his hand. The latch clicked back, and the door of Needful Things swung open. It was dim inside, but not dark. Brian could see the track lighting, a specialty of the Dick Perry Siding and Door Company, had been installed, and a few of the spots mounted on the tracks were lit. They were trained on a number of glass display cases, which were arranged around the large room. The cases were, for the most part, empty. The spots highlighted the few objects which were in the cases. The floor, which had been bare wood when this was Western Maine Realty and Insurance, had been covered in a rich wall-to-wall carpet the color of burgundy wine. The walls had been painted eggshell white. A thin light, as white as the walls, filtered in through the soaped display window. "Well, it's a mistake just the same," Brian thought. "He hasn't even gotten his stock in yet. Whoever put the open sign in the door by mistake left the door unlocked by mistake, too. The polite thing to do in these circumstances would be to close the door again, get on his bike, and ride away." Yet he was loath to leave. He was, after all, actually seeing the inside of the new store. His mother would talk to him the rest of the afternoon when she heard that. The maddening part was this. He wasn't sure exactly what he was seeing. There were half a dozen exhibits, items in the display cases, and the spotlights were trained on them, a kind of trial run, probably. But he couldn't tell what they were. He could, however, tell what they weren't. Spool beds and moldy crank telephones. "Hello?" he asked uncertainly, still standing in the doorway. "Is anybody here?" He was about to grasp the doorknob and pull the door shut again when a voice replied, "I'm here." A tall figure, what at first seemed to be an impossibly tall figure, came through a doorway behind one of the display cases. The doorway was masked with a dark velvet curtain. Brian felt a momentary and quite monstrous cramp of fear. Then the glow thrown by one of the spots slanted across the man's face, and Brian's fear was allayed. The guy was quite old, and his face was very kind. He looked at Brian with interest and pleasure. "Your door was unlocked," Brian began, "so I thought..." "Of course it's unlocked," the tall man said. "I decided to open for a little while this afternoon as a kind of preview. And you are my very first customer. Come in, my friend. Enter freely and leave some of the happiness you bring." He smiled and stuck out his hand. The smile was infectious. Brian felt an instant liking for the proprietor of Needful Things. He had to step over the threshold and into the shop to clasp the tall man's hand, and he did so without a single qualm. The door swung shut behind him and latched of its own accord. Brian did not notice. He was too busy noticing that the tall man's eyes were dark blue, exactly the same shade as Miss Sally Ratcliffe's eyes. They could have been father and daughter. The tall man's grip was strong and sure, but not painful. All the same, there was something unpleasant about it, something smooth, too hard somehow. "I'm pleased to meet you," Brian said. Those dark blue eyes fastened on his face like hooded railroad lanterns. "I am equally pleased to make your acquaintance," the tall man said. And that was how Brian Rusk met the proprietor of Needful Things before anyone else in Castle Rock. "My name is Leland Gaunt," the tall man said. "And you are?"
"Brian. Brian Rusk."
"Very good, Mr. Rusk. And since you are my first customer, I think I can offer you a very special price on any item that catches your fancy."
"Well, thank you," Brian said, "but I don't really think I could buy anything in a place like this. I don't get my allowance until Friday, and..."
He looked doubtfully at the glass display cases again.
"Well, You don't look like you've got all your stock in yet.
Gaunt smiled. His teeth were crooked, and they looked rather yellow in the dim light. But Brian found the smile entirely charming, just the same. Once more, he found himself almost forced to answer it.
No, Leland Gaunt said.
No, I don't. The majority of my stock, as you put it, will arrive later this evening, but I still have quite a few interesting items. Take a look around, young Mr. Rusk. I'd love to have your opinion, if nothing else.
And I imagine you have a mother, don't you?
Of course you do. A fine young man like yourself is certainly no orphan.
Am I right?
Brian nodded, still smiling.
Sure. Ma's home right now.
An idea struck him. Would you like me to bring her down?
But the moment the proposal was out of his mouth, he was sorry. He didn't want to bring his mother down.
Tomorrow, Mr. Leland Gaunt would belong to the whole town. Tomorrow, his ma and Myra Evans would start pawing him over, along with all the other ladies in Castle Rock. Brian supposed that Mr. Gaunt would have ceased to seem so strange and different by the end of the month, heck, maybe by the end of the week, but right now he still was. Right now he belonged to Brian Rusk, and Brian Rusk alone, and Brian wanted to keep it that way. So he was pleased when Mr. Gaunt raised one hand. The fingers were extremely narrow and extremely long, and Brian noticed the first and second were of exactly the same length, and shook his head.
Not at all, he said. That's exactly what I don't want. She would undoubtedly want to bring a friend, wouldn't she?
Yeah, Brian said, thinking of Myra. Perhaps even two friends, or three.
No, this is better, Brian. May I call you Brian?
Sure, Brian said, amused.
Thank you. And you will call me Mr. Gaunt, since I am your elder, if not necessarily your better. Agreed?
Sure.
Brian wasn't sure what Mr. Gaunt meant by elders and betters, but he loved to listen to this guy talk. And his eyes were really something. Brian could hardly take his own eyes off them.
Yes, this is much better.
Mr. Gaunt rubbed his long hands together, and they made a hissing sound. This was one thing Brian was less than crazy about. Mr. Gaunt's hands, rubbing together that way, sounded like a snake which is upset and thinking of biting.
You will tell your mother, perhaps even show her what you bought, should you buy something.
Brian considered telling Mr. Gaunt that he had a grand total of 91 cents in his pocket and decided not to.
And she will tell her friends, and they will tell their friends. You see, Brian, you will be a better advertisement than the local paper could even think of being. I could not do better if I hired you to walk the streets of the town wearing a sandwich board.
Well, if you say so, Brian agreed. He had no idea what a sandwich board was, but he was quite sure he would never allow himself to be caught dead wearing one.
It would be sort of fun to look around at what little there is to look at, he was too polite to add.
Then start looking, Mr. Gaunt said, gesturing toward the cases. Brian noticed that he was wearing a long red velvet jacket. He thought it might actually be a smoking jacket, like in the Sherlock Holmes stories he had read. It was neat.
Be my guest, Brian.
Brian walked slowly over to the case nearest the door. He glanced over his shoulder, sure that Mr. Gaunt would be trailing along right behind him, but Mr. Gaunt was still standing by the door, looking at him with wry amusement. It was as if he had read Brian's mind and had discovered how much Brian disliked having the owner of a store trailing around after him while he was looking at stuff. He supposed most storekeepers were afraid that you'd break something or hawk something or both.
"Take your time," Mr. Gaunt said.
"Shopping is a joy when one takes one's time, Brian, and a pain in the nether quarters when one doesn't."
"Say, are you from overseas somewhere?" Brian asked.
Mr. Gaunt's use of "one" instead of "you" interested him. It reminded him of the old stud muffin who hosted Masterpiece Theater, which his mother sometimes watched if the TV guide said it was a love story.
"I," Gaunt said, "am from Akron."
"Is that in England?"
"That is in Ohio," Leland Gaunt said gravely, and then revealed his strong, irregular teeth in a sunny grin.
It struck Brian as funny, the way lines in TV shows like Cheers often struck him funny. In fact, this whole thing made him feel as if he had wandered into a TV show, one that was a little mysterious, but not really threatening. he burst out laughing. He had a moment to worry that Mr. Gaunt might think he was rude, perhaps because his mother was always accusing him of rudeness, and as a result Brian had come to believe he lived in a huge and nearly invisible spider's web of social etiquette. And then the tall man joined him. The two of them laughed together, and all in all, Brian could not remember when he had had such a pleasant afternoon as this one was turning out to be. "Go on, look," Mr. Gaunt said, waving his hand. "We will exchange histories another time, Brian." So Brian looked. There were only 5 items in the biggest glass case, which looked as if it might comfortably hold 20 or 30 more. One was a pipe. Another was a picture of Elvis Presley, wearing his white jumpsuit with the tiger on the back and a red scarf. The king, this was how his mother always referred to him, was holding a microphone to his pouty lips. The 3rd item was a Polaroid camera. The 4th was a piece of polished rock with a hollow full of crystal chips in its center. They caught and flashed gorgeously in the overhead spot. The 5th was a splinter of wood about as long and as thick as one of Brian's forefingers. He pointed to the crystal. "That's a geode, isn't it?" "You're a well-educated young man, Brian. That's just what it is. I have little plaques for most of my items, but they're not unpacked yet, like most of the stock. I'll have to work like the very devil if I'm going to be ready to open tomorrow." But he didn't sound worried at all, and seemed perfectly content to remain where he was. "What's that one?" Brian asked, pointing at the splinter. He was thinking to himself that this was very odd stock indeed for a small-town store. He had taken a strong and instant liking to Leland Gaunt, but if the rest of his stuff was like this, Brian didn't think he'd be doing business in Castle Rock for long. If you wanted to sell stuff like pipes and pictures of the king and splinters of wood, New York was the place where you wanted to set up shop, or so he'd come to believe from the movies he'd seen, anyway. "Ah," Mr. Gaunt said, "that's an interesting item. Let me show it to you." He crossed the room, went around the end of the case, pulled a fat ring of keys from his pocket, and selected one with hardly a glance. He opened the case and took the splinter out carefully. "Hold out your hand, Brian." "Gee, maybe I better not," Brian said. As a native of a state where tourism was a major industry, he had been in quite a few gift shops in his time, and he had seen a great many signs with this little poem printed on them. "Lovely to look at, delightful to hold, but if you break it, then it's sold." He could imagine his mother's horrified reaction if he broke the splinter, or whatever it was, and Mr. Gaunt, no longer so friendly, told him its price was $500. "Why ever not?" Mr. Gaunt asked, raising his eyebrows. But there was really only one brow. It was bushy and grew across the top of his nose in an unbroken double wave. "Well, I'm pretty clumsy." "Nonsense," Mr. Gaunt replied. "I know clumsy boys when I see them. You're not one of that breed." He dropped the splinter into Brian's palm. Brian looked at it resting there in some surprise. He hadn't even been aware his palm was open until he saw the splinter resting on it. It certainly didn't feel like a splinter. It felt more like... "It feels like stone," he said dubiously, and raised his eyes to look at Mr. Gaunt. "Both wood and stone," Mr. Gaunt said. "It's petrified." "Petrified?" Brian marveled. He looked at the splinter closely, then ran one finger along its side. It was smooth and bumpy at the same time. It was somehow not an entirely pleasant feeling. "It must be old." "Over 2,000 years old," Mr. Gaunt agreed gravely. "Cripes!" Brian said. He jumped and almost dropped the splinter. He closed his hand around it in a fist to keep it from falling to the floor, and at once a feeling of oddness and distortion swept over him. He suddenly felt... what? Dizzy? No. Not dizzy, but far, as if part of him had been lifted out of his body and swept away. He could see Mr. Gaunt looking at him with interest and amusement, and Mr. Gaunt's eyes suddenly seemed to grow to the size of tea saucers. Yet this feeling of disorientation was not frightening. It was rather exciting, and certainly more pleasant than the slick feel of the wood had been to his exploring finger. "Close your eyes," Mr. Gaunt invited. "Close your eyes, Brian, and tell me what you feel." Brian closed his eyes and stood there for a moment without moving, his right arm held out,
the fist at the end of it enclosing the splinter. He did not see Mr. Gaunt's upper lip lift, dog-like, over his large, crooked teeth for a moment, in what might have been a grimace of pleasure or anticipation. He had a vague sensation of movement, a corkscrewing kind of movement, a sound, quick and light. Thud-thud, thud-thud, thud-thud. He knew that sound. It was... "A boat!" he cried, delighted, without opening his eyes. "I feel like I'm on a boat!" "Do you indeed?" Mr. Gaunt said, and to Brian's ears he sounded impossibly distant. The sensations intensified. Now he felt as if he were going up and down across long, slow waves. He could hear the distant cry of birds, and closer the sound of many animals, cows lowing, roosters crowing, the low, snarling cry of a very big cat. Not a sound of rage, but an expression of boredom. In that one second, he could almost feel wood, the wood of which this splinter had once been a part, he was sure, under his feet, and knew that the feet themselves were not wearing Converse sneakers, but some sort of sandals, and... Then it was going, dwindling to a tiny, bright point, like the light of a TV screen when the power cuts out, and then it was gone. He opened his eyes, shaken and exhilarated. His hand had curled into such a tight fist around the splinter that he actually had to will his fingers to open, and the joints creaked like rusty door hinges. "Hey, boy," he said softly. "Neat, isn't it?" Mr. Gaunt asked cheerily, and plucked the splinter from Brian's palm with the absent skill of a doctor drawing a splinter from flesh. He returned it to its place and relocked the cabinet with a flourish. "Neat," Brian agreed in a long outrush of breath, which was almost a sigh. He bent to look at the splinter. His hand still tingled a little where he had held it. Those feelings, the up-tilt and down-slant of the deck, the thudding of the waves on the hull, the feel of the wood under his feet, those things lingered with him, although he guessed, with a feeling of real sorrow, that they would pass, as dreams pass. "Are you familiar with the story of Noah and the Ark?" Mr. Gaunt inquired. Brian frowned. He was pretty sure it was a Bible story, but he had a tendency to zone out during Sunday sermons and Thursday night Bible classes. "Was that like a boat that went around the world in 80 days? He asked. Mr. Gaunt grinned again. "Something like that, Brian. Something very like that. Well, that splinter is supposed to be from Noah's Ark. Of course, I can't say it is from Noah's Ark, because people would think I was the most outrageous sort of fake. There must be 4,000 people in the world today trying to sell pieces of wood which they claim to be from Noah's Ark, and probably 400,000 trying to peddle pieces of the one true cross. But I can say it's over 2,000 years old, because it's carbon-dated, and I can say it came from the Holy Land, although it was found not on Mount Ararat, but on Mount Borum." Most of this was lost on Brian, but the most salient fact was not. 2,000 years, he breathed. "Wow, you're really sure?" "I am indeed," Mr. Gaunt said. "I have a certificate from MIT where it was carbon dated, and that goes with the item, of course. But you know, I really believe it might be from the Ark." He looked at the splinter speculatively for a moment, and then raised his dazzling blue eyes to Brian's hazel ones. Brian was again transfixed at once by that gaze. "After all, Mount Borum is less than 17 kilometers, as the crow flies, from Mount Ararat, and greater mistakes than the final resting place of a boat, even a big one, have been made in the many histories of the world, especially when stories are handed down from mouth to ear for generations before they are finally committed to paper. Am I right?" "Yeah," Brian said. "Sounds logical. And besides, it produces an odd sensation when it's held. Wouldn't you say so?" "I guess." Mr. Gaunt smiled and ruffled the boy's hair, breaking the spell. "I like you, Brian. I wish all my customers could be as full of wonder as you are. Life would be much easier for a humble tradesman such as myself, if that were the way of the world." How much would you sell something like that for?" Brian asked. He pointed toward the splinter with a finger which was not quite steady. He was only now beginning to realize how deeply the experience had affected him. It had been like holding a conch shell to your ear and hearing the sound of the ocean,
only in 3D and sensorround. He dearly wished Mr. Gaunt would let him hold it again, perhaps even a little longer, but he didn't know how to ask, and Mr. Gaunt did not offer.
"Oh, now," Mr. Gaunt said, steepling his fingers below his chin and looking at Brian roguishly. "With an item like that, and with most of the good things I sell, the really interesting things, that would depend on the buyer, what the buyer would be willing to pay. What would you be willing to pay, Brian?"
"I don't know," Brian said, thinking of the 91 cents in his pocket, and then gulped, "A lot."
Mr. Gaunt threw back his head and laughed heartily. Brian noticed, when he did, that he'd made a mistake about the man. When he first came in, he had thought Mr. Gaunt's hair was gray. Now he saw that it was only silver at the temples. He must have been standing in one of the spotlights, Brian thought.
"Well, this has been terribly interesting, Brian, but I really do have a lot of work ahead of me before 10 tomorrow, and so..."
"Sure," Brian said, startled back into a consideration of good manners, in which his ma was fond of telling him he was almost entirely lacking. "I have to go, too. Sorry to have kept you so long."
"No, no, no! You misunderstand me."
Mr. Gaunt laid one of his long hands on Brian's arm. Brian pulled his arm away. He hoped the gesture didn't seem impolite, but he couldn't help it, even if it did. Mr. Gaunt's hand was hard and dry and somehow unpleasant. It did not feel that different, in fact, from the chunk of petrified wood that was supposed to be from Noah's Ark or whatever it was. But Mr. Gaunt was too much in earnest to notice Brian's instinctive shrinking away. He acted as if he, not Brian, had committed a breach of etiquette.
"I just thought we ought to get down to business. There's no sense, really, in your looking at the few other things I've managed to unpack. There aren't very many of them, and you've seen the most interesting of those which are out. Yet I have a pretty good knowledge of my own stock, even without an inventory sheet in my hand, and I might have something you'd fancy, Brian." "What would you fancy?"
"Jeepers," Brian said. There were 1,000 things he would fancy, and that was part of the problem. When the question was put as baldly as that, he couldn't say just which of the 1,000 he would fancy the most.
"It's best not to think too deeply about these things," Mr. Gaunt said.
He spoke idly, but there was nothing idle about his eyes, which were studying Brian's face closely.
"When I say, 'Brian Rusk, what do you want more than anything else in the world at this moment? What is your response? Quick!'"
"Sandy Koufax," Brian responded promptly. He had not been aware that his palm was open to receive the splinter from Nora's Ark until he had seen it resting there, and he hadn't been aware of what he was going to say in response to Mr. Gaunt's question until he heard the words tumbling from his mouth. But the moment he heard them, he knew they were exactly and completely right.
"Sandy Koufax," Mr. Gaunt said thoughtfully. "How interesting."
"Well, not Sandy Koufax himself," Brian said, "but his baseball card."
"Tops or Fleers?" Mr. Gaunt asked.
Brian hadn't really believed the afternoon could get any better, but suddenly it had. Mr. Gaunt knew about baseball cards as well as splinters and geodes. It was amazing, really amazing.
"Tops?"
"I suppose it's his rookie card you'd be interested in," Mr. Gaunt said regretfully. "I don't think I could help you there, but..."
"No," Brian said. "Not 1954. 56. That's the one I'd like to have. I've got a collection of 1956 baseball cards. My dad got me going on it. It's really fun, and there are only a few of them that are really expensive. Al Kaline, Mel Parnell, Roy Campanella, guys like that. I've got over 50 already, including Al Kaline. He was $38. I mowed a lot of lawns to get Al."
"I bet you did," Mr. Gaunt said with a smile.
"Well, like I say, most 56 cards aren't really expensive. They cost $5, $7, sometimes $10. But a Sandy Koufax in good condition cost $90 or even $100. He wasn't a big star that year, but of course he turned out to be great. And that was when the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn. Everybody called them the bums back then. That's what my dad says, at least."
"Your dad is 200% correct," said Mr. Gaunt.
"I believe I have something that's going to make you very happy, Brian. Wait right here."
He brushed back through the curtained doorway and left Brian standing by the case with the splinter and the Polaroid and the picture of the king in it. Brian was almost dancing from one foot to the other in hope and anticipation. He told himself to stop being such a wuss, even if Mr. Gaunt did have a Sandy Koufax card, and even if it was a Topps card from the 50s,
It would probably turn out to be a 55 or a 57. And suppose it was a 56. What good was it going to do him with less than a buck in his pocket? Well, I can look at it, can't I? Brian thought. It doesn't cost anything to look, does it? This was also another of his mother's favorite sayings. From the room behind the curtain, there came the sounds of boxes being shifted and mild thuds as they were set on the floor. "Just a minute, Brian," Mr. Gaunt called. He sounded a little out of breath. "I'm sure there's a shoebox here someplace." "Don't go to any trouble on my account, Mr. Gaunt," Brian called back, hoping like mad that Mr. Gaunt would go to as much trouble as was necessary. "Maybe that box is in one of the shipments still en route," Mr. Gaunt said dubiously. Brian's heart sank. Then, "But I was sure." "Wait, here it is, right here." Brian's heart rose, did more than rise. It soared and did a back-over flip. Mr. Gaunt came back through the curtain. His hair was a trifle disarrayed, and there was a smudge of dust on one lapel of his smoking jacket. In his hands, he held a box which had once contained a pair of Air Jordan sneakers. He set it on the counter and took off the top. Brian stood by his left arm, looking in. The box was full of baseball cards, each inserted in its own plastic envelope, just like the ones Brian sometimes bought at the baseball card shop in North Conway, New Hampshire. "I thought there might be an inventory sheet in here, but no such luck," Mr. Gaunt said. "Still, I have a pretty good idea of what I have in stock, as I told you. It's the key to running a business where you sell a little bit of everything, and I'm quite sure I saw..." He trailed off and began flipping rapidly through the cards. Brian watched the cards flash by, speechless with astonishment. The guy who ran the baseball card shop had what his dad called a pretty country fair selection of old cards, but the contents of the whole store couldn't hold a candle to the treasures tucked away in this one sneaker box. There were chewing tobacco cards with pictures of Ty Cobb and Pi Trainer on them. There were cigarette cards with pictures of Babe Ruth and Dom DiMaggio and Big George Keller and even Hiram Disson, the one-armed pitcher who had chucked for the White Sox during the 40s. "Lucky Strike Green has gone to war," many of the cigarette cards proclaimed. And there, just glimpsed, a broad, solemn face above a Pittsburgh uniform shirt. "My God, wasn't that Honus Wagner?" Brian gasped. His heart felt like a very small bird which had blundered into his throat and now fluttered there, trapped. "That's the rarest baseball card in the universe!" "Yes, yes," Mr. Gaunt said absently. His long fingers shuttled speedily through the cards, faces from another age trapped under transparent plastic coverings, men who had whacked the pill and chucked the apple and covered the anchors, heroes of a grand and bygone golden age, an age of which this boy still harbored cheerful and lively dreams. "A little of everything, that's what a successful business is all about, Brian. Diversity, pleasure, amazement, fulfillment. What a successful life is all about, for that matter. I don't give advice, but if I did, you could do worse than remember that. Now, let me see. Somewhere. Ah!" He pulled a card from the middle of the box, like a magician doing a trick, and placed it triumphantly in Brian's hand. It was Sandy Koufax. It was a 56 Topps card. And it was signed, "To my good friend Brian, with best wishes, Sandy Koufax," Brian read in a hoarse whisper, and then found he could say nothing at all. He looked up at Mr. Gaunt, his mouth working. Mr. Gaunt smiled. "I didn't plan it, Brian. It's just a coincidence, but a nice sort of coincidence, don't you think?" Brian still couldn't talk, and so settled for a single nod of his head. The plastic envelope with its precious cargo felt weirdly heavy in his hand. "Take it out," Mr. Gaunt invited. When Brian's voice finally emerged from his mouth again, it was the croak of a very old invalid. "I don't dare." "Well, I do," Mr. Gaunt said. He took the envelope from Brian, reached inside with the carefully manicured nail of one finger, and slid the card out. He put it in Brian's hand. He could see tiny dents in the surface. They had been made by the point of the pen Sandy Koufax had used to sign his name. Their names. Koufax's signature was almost the same as the printed one, except the printed signature said Sanford Koufax, and the autograph said Sandy Koufax. Also, it was 1,000 times better because it was real. Sandy Koufax had held this card in his hand and had imposed his mark upon it, the mark of his living hand and magic name. But there was another name on it as well, Brian's own. Some boy with his name had been standing by the Ebbets Field bullpen before the game, and Sandy Koufax, the real Sandy Koufax, young and strong, his glory years just ahead of him, had taken the offered card, probably still smelling of sweet pink bubblegum, and had set his mark upon it. And mine, too, Brian thought. Suddenly it came again, the feeling which had swept over him when he held the splinter of petrified wood, only this time it was much, much stronger. Smell of grass, sweet and fresh cut, heavy smack of ash on horsehide, yells and laughter from the batting cage. "Hello, Mr. Koufax, could you sign your card for me?" A narrow face, brown eyes, darkish hair. The cap comes off briefly. He scratches his head just above the hairline, then puts the cap back on. "Sure, kid." He takes the card. "What's your name?" "Brian, sir. Brian Seguin." Scratch, scratch, scratch on the card. The magic. The inscribed fire. "You want to be a ball player when you grow up, Brian?" The question has the feel of rote recital, and he speaks without raising his face from the card he holds in his large right hand so he can write on it with his soon-to-be magic left hand. "Yes, sir." "Practice your fundamentals." And hands the card back. "Yes, sir." But he's already walking away. Then he's breaking into a lazy run on the fresh-cut grass as he jogs toward the bullpen with his shadow jogging along beside him. "Brian? Brian?" Long fingers were snapping under his nose, Mr. Gaunt's fingers. Brian came out of his daze and saw Mr. Gaunt looking at him, amused. "Are you there, Brian?" "Sorry," Brian said and blushed. He knew he should hand the card back. Hand it back and get out of here, but he couldn't seem to let it go. Mr. Gaunt was staring into his eyes, right into his head, it seemed, again, and once more he found it impossible to look away. "So," Mr. Gaunt said softly, "let us say, Brian, that you are the buyer. Let us say that. How much would you pay for that card?" Brian felt despair like a rock slide weight his heart. "All I've got is..." Mr. Gaunt's left hand flew up. "Shh," he said sternly. "Bite your tongue. The buyer must never tell the seller how much he has. You might as well hand the vendor your wallet and turn the contents of your pockets out on the floor in the bargain. If you can't tell a lie, then be still. It's the first rule of fair trade, Brian, my boy." His eyes, so large and dark, Brian felt that he was swimming in them. "There are two prices for this card, Brian. Half and half. One half is cash. The other is a deed. Do you understand?" "Yes," Brian said. He felt far again, far away from Castle Rock, far away from needful things, even far away from himself. The only things which were real in this far place were Mr. Gaunt's wide, dark eyes. "The cash price for that 1956 autographed Sandy Koufax card is 85 cents, Mr. Gaunt said. "Does that seem fair?" "Yes," Brian said. His voice was far and wee. He felt himself dwindling, dwindling away, and approaching the point where any clear memory would cease. "Good," Mr. Gaunt's caressing voice said. "Our trading has progressed well thus far. As for the deed, do you know a woman named Wilma Jerzyk, Brian?" "Wilma, sure," Brian said out of his growing darkness. "She lives on the other side of the block from us." "Yes, I believe she does," Mr. Gaunt agreed. "Listen carefully, Brian." So he must have gone on speaking, but Brian did not remember what he said. The next thing he was aware of was Mr. Gaunt shooing him gently out onto Main Street, telling him how much he had enjoyed meeting him, and asking him to tell his mother and all his friends that he had been well-treated and fairly dealt with. "Sure," Brian said. He felt bewildered, but he also felt very good, as if he had just awakened from a refreshing early afternoon nap. "And come again," Mr. Gaunt said, just before he shut the door. Brian looked at it. The sign hanging there now read, closed. It seemed to Brian that he had been in needful things for hours, but the clock outside the bank said it was only 10 of 4. It had been less than 20 minutes. He prepared to mount his bike, then leaned the handlebars against his belly while he reached into his pants pocket. From one, he drew 6 bright copper pennies. From the other, he drew the autographed Sandy Koufax card. They apparently had made some sort of deal, although Brian could not for the life of him remember exactly what it had been, only that Wilma Jurzik's name had been mentioned. To my good friend Brian, with best wishes, Sandy Koufax. Whatever deal they had made, this was worth it. A card like this was worth practically anything. Brian tucked it carefully into his knapsack so it wouldn't get bent, mounted his bike, and began to pedal home fast. He grinned all the way. When a new shop opens in a small New England town, the residents, hicks though they may be and many other things, display a cosmopolitan attitude which their city cousins can rarely match. In New York or Los Angeles, a new gallery may attract a little knot of might-be patrons and simple lookers-on before the doors are opened for the first time. A new club may even garner a line and police barricades with paparazzi armed with gadget bags and telephoto lenses standing expectantly beyond them. There is an excited hum of conversation as among theatergoers on Broadway before the opening of a new play which, smash hit or drop dead flop, is sure to cause comment. When a new shop opens in a small New England town, there is rarely a crowd before the doors open and never a line. When the shades are drawn up, the doors unlocked, and the new concern declared open for business, customers come and go in a trickle which would undoubtedly strike an outsider as apathetic and probably as an ill omen for the shopkeeper's future prosperity. What seems like a lack of interest often masks keen anticipation and even keener observation. Cora Rusk and Myra Evans were not the only two women in Castle Rock who had kept the telephone lines buzzing about needful things in the weeks before it opened. That interest and anticipation do not change the small-town shopper's conservative code of conduct, however. Certain things are simply not done, particularly not in the tight Yankee enclaves north of Boston. These are societies which exist for 9 months of every year, mostly sufficient unto themselves, and it is considered bad form to show too much interest too soon, or in any way to indicate that one has felt more than a passing interest, so to speak. Investigating a new shop in a small town and attending a socially prestigious party in a large city are both activities which cause a fair amount of excitement among those likely to participate, and there are rules for both. Rules which are unspoken, immutable, and strangely similar. The chief among these is that one must not arrive first. Of course, someone has to break this cardinal rule, or no one would arrive at all, but a new shop is apt to stand empty for at least 20 minutes after the closed sign in the window has been turned over to read open for the first time, and a knowledgeable observer would feel safe in wagering that the first arrivals would come in a group, a pair, a trio, but more likely a foursome of ladies. The second rule is that the investigating shoppers display a politeness so complete that it verges on iciness. The third is that no one must ask, on the first visit at least, for the new shopkeeper's history or bona fides. The fourth is that no one should bring a welcome-to-town present, especially one as tacky as a homemade cake or pie. The last rule is as immutable as the first. One must not depart last. This stately gavotte, which might be called the dance of female investigation, lasts anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months and does not apply when someone from town opens a business. That sort of opening is apt to be like an old home week church supper, informal, cheery, and quite dull. But when the new tradesman is from away, it is always said that way so one can hear the capital letters, the dance of female investigation is as sure as the fact of death and the force of gravity. When the trial period is over, no one takes out an ad in the paper to say that it is, but somehow everyone knows, one of two things happens. Either the flow of trade becomes more normal and satisfied customers bring in belated welcome gifts and invitations to come and visit, or the new business fails. In towns like Castle Rock, small businesses are sometimes spoken of as broke down months or even weeks before the hapless owners discover the fact for themselves. There was at least one woman in Castle Rock who did not play by the accepted rules, immutable as they might seem to others. This was Polly Chalmers, who ran You So-and-So. Ordinary behavior was not expected of her by most. Polly Chalmers was considered by most Castle Rock ladies, and many of the gentlemen, to be eccentric. Polly presented all sorts of problems for the self-appointed social arbiters of Castle Rock. For one thing, no one could quite decide on the most basic fact of all. Was Polly from town, or was she from away? She had been born in Castle Rock, true enough, but she had left with Duke Sheehan's bun in her oven at the age of 18. That had been in 1970, and she had only returned once before moving back for good in 1987. That brief return call had begun in late 1975, when her father had been dying from cancer of the bowel. Following his death, Lorraine Chalmers had suffered a heart attack, and Polly had stayed on to nurse her mother. Lorraine had suffered a second heart attack, this one fatal, in the early spring of 1976, and after her mother had been buried away in Homeland, Polly, who had by then attained a genuine air of mystery as far as the ladies of the town were concerned, had left again. Gone for good this time, had been the general consensus, and when the last remaining Chalmers, old Aunt Evie, died in 1981 and Polly did not attend the funeral, the consensus seemed a proven fact. Yet 4 years ago she had returned and had opened her sewing shop. Although no one knew for certain, it seemed likely that she had used Aunt Evie Chalmers's money to fund the new venture. Who else would that crazy old rip have left it to? The town's more avid followers of La Comédie Humaine, this was most of them, felt sure that if Polly made a success of her little business and stuck around, most of the things they were curious about would be revealed to them in the fullness of time. But in Polly's case, many matters remained dark. It was really quite exasperating. She had spent some of the intervening years in San Francisco. That much was known, but little more. Lorraine Chalmers had been as close as the devil about her wayward daughter. Had Polly gone to school there or somewhere? She ran her business as if she had taken business courses and learned to write smart from them, too, but no one could say for sure. She was single when she returned, but had she ever been married, either in San Francisco or in one of those places where she might or might not have spent some of her time between then and now? No one knew that either, only that she had never married the Sheehan boy. He had joined the Marines, had done a few turns there, and was now selling real estate somewhere in New Hampshire. And why had she come back here to stay after all the years? Most of all, they wondered about the baby. Had pretty Polly gotten an abortion? Had she given it up for adoption? Had she kept it? If so, had it died? Was it, maddening pronoun that, alive now, at school somewhere, and writing the occasional letter home to its mother? No one knew these things either, and in many ways the unanswered questions about it were the most galling. The girl who had left on a greyhound with a bun in her oven was now a woman of almost 40 and had been back, living and doing business in town for 4 years, and no one even knew the sex of the child that had caused her to leave. Just lately, Polly Chalmers had given the town a fresh demonstration of her eccentricity, if one was needed. She had begun keeping company with Alan Pangborn, Castle County's sheriff, and Sheriff Pangborn had buried his wife and younger son only a year and a half ago. This behavior was not quite a scandal, but it was certainly eccentric. And so no one was really surprised to see Polly Chalmers go marching down the sidewalk of Main Street from her door to that of Needful Things at 10:02 on the morning of October 9th. They were not even surprised at what she was carrying in her gloved hands, a Tupperware container which could only contain a cake. It was, the locals said when discussing it later, just like her. The display window of Needful Things had been cleansed of soap, and a dozen or so items had been set out there. Clocks, a silver setting, a painting, a lovely triptych just waiting for someone to fill it with well-loved photographs. Polly glanced at these items with approval, then went to the door. The sign hanging there read open. As she did what the sign suggested, a small bell jingled over her head. This had been installed since Brian Rusk's preview.
The shop smelled of new carpeting and fresh paint. It was filled with sunshine, and as she stepped in, looking around with interest, a clear thought came to her. This is a success. Not a customer has stepped through the door yet, unless I'm one, and it's already a success. Remarkable. Such hasty judgments were not like her, and neither was her feeling of instant approval, but they were undeniable. A tall man was bending over one of the glass display cases. He looked up when the bell jingled and smiled at her. "Hello," he said. Polly was a practical woman who knew her own mind and generally liked what she found there, and so the instant of confusion which struck her when she first met this stranger's eyes was confusing in and of itself. "I know him," was the first clear thought to come through that unexpected cloud. "I've met this man before." "Where?" She hadn't, though, and that knowledge, that surety, came a moment later. It was déjà vu, she supposed, that sense of false recollection, which strikes almost everyone from time to time, a feeling which is disorienting because it is at once so dreamy and so prosaic. She was put off her stride for a moment or two and could only smile at him lamely. Then she moved her left hand to get a better grip on the cake container she held, and a harsh bolt of pain shot up the back of it and out toward the wrist in two bright spikes. The tines of a large chrome fork seemed to be planted deep in her flesh. It was arthritis, and it hurt like a son of a bitch, but at least it focused her attention again, and she spoke without a noticeable lag. Only she thought that the man might have noticed just the same. He had bright hazel eyes, which looked as if they might notice a great deal. "Hi," she said. "My name is Polly Chalmers. I own the little dress and sewing shop 2 doors down from you. I thought that, since we're neighbors, I'd come over and welcome you to Castle Rock before the rush." He smiled, and his entire face lit up. She felt an answering smile lift her own lips, even though her left hand was still hurting like a bastard. "If I weren't already in love with Alan," she thought, "I think I'd fall at this man's feet without a whimper. Show me to the bedroom, master. I will go quietly." With a quirk of amusement, she wondered how many of the ladies who would pop in here for a quick peek before the end of the day would go home with ravening crushes on him. She saw he was wearing no wedding band. More fuel to the fire. "I'm delighted to meet you, Ms. Chalmers," he said, coming forward. "I'm Leland Gaunt." He put out his right hand as he approached her, then frowned slightly as she took a small step backward. "I'm sorry," she said. I don't shake hands. Don't think me impolite, please. I have arthritis." She set the Tupperware container on the nearest glass case and raised her hands, which were encased in kid leather gloves. There was nothing freakish about them, but they were clearly misshapen, the left a little more than the right. There were women in town who thought that Polly was actually proud of her disease. Why else, they reasoned, would she be so quick to show it off? The truth was the exact opposite. Though not a vain woman, she was concerned enough about her looks that the ugliness of her hands embarrassed her. She showed them as quickly as she could, and the same thought surfaced briefly, so briefly it almost always went unrecognized, in her mind each time she did. "There, that's over. Now we can get on with whatever else there is." People usually registered some discomposure or embarrassment of their own when she showed them her hands. Gaunt did not. He grasped her upper arm in hands that felt extraordinarily strong and shook that instead. It might have struck her as an inappropriately intimate thing to have done on first acquaintance, but it did not. The gesture was friendly, brief, even rather amusing. All the same, she was glad it was quick. His hands had a dry, unpleasant feel, even through the light fall coat she was wearing. "It must be difficult to run a sewing shop with that particular disability, Miss Chalmers. However do you manage?" It was a question very few people put to her, and, with the exception of Alan, she couldn't remember anyone's ever asking her in such a straightforward way. "I went right on sewing full-time as long as I could," she said. "Grinned and bore it, I suppose you'd say. Now I have half a dozen girls working for me part-time, and I stick mostly to designing. But I still have my good days." This was a lie, but she felt it did no harm, since she told it mostly for her own benefit. "Well, I'm delighted that you came over. I'll tell you the truth, I've got a bad case of stage fright." "Really? Why?" She was even less hasty about judging people than she was of judging places and events, and she was startled, even a little alarmed, at how rapidly and naturally she felt at home with this man she had met less than a minute ago.
I keep wondering what I'll do if no one comes in. No one at all day long.
They'll come, she said. They'll want to look at your stock. No one seems to have any idea what a store called Needful Things sells. But even more important, they'll want to look at you. It's just that in a little place like Castle Rock,
no one wants to seem too eager, he finished for her.
I know. I've had experience of small towns. My rational mind assures me that what you've just said is the absolute truth. But there's another voice that just goes on saying,
they won't come, Leland, old buddy. Oh, no, they won't come. They'll stay away in droves. You just wait and see.
She laughed, remembering suddenly that she had felt exactly the same way when she opened You So-and-So. But what's this? He asked, touching the Tupperware container with one hand. And she noticed what Brian Rusk had already seen. The first and second fingers of that hand were exactly the same length. It's a cake, and if I know this town half as well as I think I do, I can assure you it will be the only one you get today. He smiled at her, clearly delighted. Thank you. Thank you very much, Miss Chalmers. I'm touched. And she, who never asked anyone to use her first name on first or even short acquaintance, and who was suspicious of anyone, realtors, insurance agents, car salesmen, who appropriated that privilege unasked, was bemused to hear herself saying, if we're going to be neighbors, shouldn't you call me Polly? The cake was devil's food, as Leland Gaunt ascertained merely by lifting the lid and sniffing. He asked her to stay and have a slice with him. Polly demurred. Gaunt insisted. You'll have someone to run your shop, he said, and no one will dare set foot in mine for at least half an hour. That should satisfy the protocols, and I have 1,000 questions about the town. So she agreed. He disappeared through the curtained doorway at the back of the shop, and she heard him climbing stairs. The upstairs area, she supposed, must be his living quarters, if only temporarily, to get plates and forks. While she waited for him to come back, Polly wandered around looking at things. A framed sign on the wall by the door through which she had entered said that the shop would be open from 10 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. It would be closed, except by appointment, on Tuesdays and Thursdays until late spring. Or, Polly thought, with an interior grin, until those wild and crazy tourists and vacationers arrived again, waving their fistfuls of dollars. Needful Things, she decided, was a curio shop. An upscale curio shop, she would have said after a single glance, but a closer examination of the items for sale suggested it was not that easily categorized. The items which had been placed out when Brian stopped in the afternoon before, geode, Polaroid camera, picture of Elvis Presley, the few others, were still there, but perhaps 4 dozen more had been added. A small rug, probably worth a small fortune, hung on one of the off-white walls. It was Turkish and old. There was a collection of lead soldiers in one of the cases, possibly antiques, but Polly knew that all lead soldiers, even those cast in Hong Kong a week ago last Monday, have an antique-y look. The goods were wildly varied. Between the picture of Elvis, which looked to her like the sort of thing that would retail on any carnival midway in America for $4.99, and a singularly uninteresting American Eagle weather vane, was a carnival glass lampshade, which was certainly worth $800 and might be worth as much as $5,000. A battered and charmless teapot stood flanked by a pair of gorgeous poupées, and she could not even begin to guess what those beautiful French dollies with their rouged cheeks and gartered gams might be worth. There was a selection of baseball and tobacco cards, a fan of pulp magazines from the 30s, weird tales, astounding tales, thrilling wonder stories, a table radio from the 50s, which was that disgusting shade of pale pink which the people of that time seemed to approve of when it came to appliances, if not to politics. Most, although not all, of the items had small plaques standing in front of them. Tri-Crystal Geode, Arizona, read one. Custom Socket Wrench Kit, read another. The one in front of the splinter, which had so amazed Brian, announced it was Petrified Wood from the Holy Land. The plaques in front of the trading cards and pulp magazines read, Others Available Upon Request. All the items, whether trash or treasure, had one thing in common, she observed. There were no price tags on any of them. Gaunt arrived back with 2 small plates, plain old Corningware, nothing fancy,
a cake knife, and a couple of forks. "Everything's helter-skelter up there," he confided, removing the top of the container and setting it aside. He turned it upside down so it would not imprint a ring of frosting on the top of the cabinet he was serving from. "I'll be looking for a house as soon as I get things set to rights here, but for the time being, I'm going to live over the store. Everything's in cardboard cartons. God, I hate cardboard cartons." "Who would you say..." "Not that big," Polly protested. "My goodness!" "Okay," Gaunt said cheerfully, putting the thick slab of chocolate cake on one of the plates. "This one will be mine. Eat, Ralph. Eat, I say. Like this for you? Even thinner." "I can't cut it any thinner than this," he said, and sliced off a narrow piece of cake. "It smells heavenly. Thank you again, Polly." "You're more than welcome." It did smell good, and she wasn't on a diet, but her initial refusal had been more than first meeting politeness. The last 3 weeks had been a stretch of gorgeous Indian summer weather in Castle Rock, but on Monday the weather had turned cool, and her hands were miserable with the change. The pain would probably abate a little once her joints got used to the cooler temperatures, or so she prayed, and so it had always been, but she was not blind to the progressive nature of the disease. But since early this morning, it had been very bad. When it was like this, she was never sure what she would or would not be able to do with her traitor hands, and her initial refusal had been out of worry and potential embarrassment. Now she stripped off her gloves, flexed her right hand experimentally. A spear of hungry pain bolted up her forearm to the elbow. She flexed again, her lips compressed in anticipation. The pain came, but it wasn't as intense this time. She relaxed a little. It was going to be all right. Not great. Not as pleasant as eating cake should be, but all right. She picked up her fork carefully, bending her fingers as little as possible when she grasped it. As she conveyed the first bite to her mouth, she saw Gaunt looking at her sympathetically. "Now he'll commiserate," she thought glumly, "and tell me how bad his grandfather's arthritis was, or his ex-wife's, or somebody's." But Gaunt did not commiserate. He took a bite of cake and rolled his eyes comically. "Never mind sewing and patterns," he said. "You should have opened a restaurant." "Oh, I didn't make it," she said, "but I'll convey the compliment to Nettie Cobb. She's my housekeeper." "Nettie Cobb," he said thoughtfully, cutting another bite from his slice of cake. "Yes. Do you know her?" "Oh, I doubt it." He spoke with the air of a man who is suddenly recalled to the present moment. "I don't know anyone in Castle Rock." He looked at her slyly from the corners of his eyes. "Any chance she could be hired away?" "None," Polly said, laughing. "I was going to ask you about real estate agents," he said. "Who would you say is the most trustworthy around here?" "Oh, they're all thieves, but Mark Hopewell's probably as safe as any." He choked back laughter and put a hand to his mouth to stifle a spray of crumbs. Then he began to cough, and if her hands hadn't been so painful, she would have thumped him companionably on the back a few times. First acquaintance or not, she didn't like him. "Sorry," he said, still chuckling a little. "They are all thieves, though, aren't they?" "Oh, absolutely." Had she been another sort of woman, one who kept the facts of her own past less completely to herself, Polly would then have begun asking Leland Gaunt leading questions. Why had he come to Castle Rock? Where had he been before coming here? Would he stay long? Did he have a family? But she wasn't that other sort of woman, and so she was content to answer his questions, was delighted to, in fact, since none of them were about herself. He wanted to know about the town, and what the flow of traffic was like on Main Street during the winter, and if there was a place nearby where he could shop for a nice little Yodel stove, and insurance rates, and 100 other things. He produced a narrow black leather notebook from the pocket of the blue blazer he wore and gravely noted down each name she mentioned. She looked down at her plate and saw that she had finished all of her cake. Her hands still hurt, but they felt better than they had when she arrived. She recalled that she had almost decided against coming by because they were so miserable. Now she was glad she had done it anyway. "I have to go," she said, looking at her watch. "Rosalie will think I died." They had eaten standing up. Now Gaunt stacked their plates neatly, put the forks on top, and replaced the top on the cake container. "I'll return this as soon as the cake is gone," he said. "Is that all right?" "Perfectly." "You'll probably have it by mid-afternoon, then," he said gravely. "You don't have to be that prompt," she said as Gaunt walked her to the door. "It's been very nice to meet you." "Thanks for coming by,"
he said. For a moment she thought he meant to take her arm, and she felt a sense of dismay at the thought of his touch. Silly, of course. But he didn't. You've made what I expected to be a scary day into something of a treat instead. You'll be fine. Polly opened the door, then paused. She had asked him nothing at all about himself, but she was curious about one thing. Too curious to leave without asking. You've got all sorts of interesting things. Thank you. But nothing is priced. Why is that? He smiled. That's a little eccentricity of mine, Polly. I've always believed that a sale worth making is worth dickering over a little. I think I must have been a Middle Eastern rug merchant in my last incarnation. So, you charge whatever the market will bear, she asked, teasing just a little. You could say so, he agreed seriously, and again she was struck by how deep his hazel eyes were, how oddly beautiful. I'd rather think of it as defining worth, by need. I see. Do you really? Well, I think so. It explains the name of the shop. He smiled. It might, he said. I suppose it might, at that. Well, I'll wish you a very good day, Mr. Gaunt. Leland, please. Or just Lee. Leland, then. And you're not to worry about customers. I think by Friday you'll have to hire a security guard to shoo them out at the end of the day. Do you? That would be lovely. Goodbye. Ciao, he said, and closed the door after her. He stood there a moment, watching as Polly Chalmers walked down the street, smoothing her gloves over her hands, so misshapen, and in such startling contrast to the rest of her, which was trim and pretty, if not terribly remarkable. Gaunt's smile grew. As his lips drew back, exposing his uneven teeth, it became unpleasantly predatory. You'll do, he said softly in the empty shop. You'll do just fine. Polly's prediction proved quite correct. By closing time that day, almost all of the women in Castle Rock, those who mattered anyway, and several men had stopped by Needful Things for a quick browse. Almost all of them were at some pains to assure Gaunt that they only had a moment because they were on their way to someplace else. Stephanie Bonsaint, Cynthia Rose Martin, Barbara Miller, and Francine Pelletier were the first. Steffi, Cindy Rose, Babs, and Francie arrived in a protective bunch not 10 minutes after Polly was observed leaving the new shop. The news of her departure spread quickly and thoroughly by telephone and the efficient bush telegraph which runs through New England backyards. Steffi and her friends looked. They oohed and aahed. They assured Gaunt they could not stay long because this was their bridge day, neglecting to tell him that the weekly rubber usually did not start until about 2 p.m. Francie asked him where he came from. Gaunt told her Akron, Ohio. Steffi asked him if he had been in the antiques business for long. Gaunt told her he did not consider it to be the antiques business, exactly. Cindy wanted to know if Mr. Gaunt had been in New England long. A while, Gaunt replied. A while. All four agreed later that the shop was interesting, so many odd things, but it had been a very unsuccessful interview. The man was as closed-mouthed as Polly Chalmers, perhaps more. Babs then pointed out what they all knew, or thought they knew, that Polly had been the first person in town to actually enter the new shop and that she had brought a cake. Perhaps, Babs speculated, she knew Mr. Gaunt from that time before, that time she had spent away. Cindy Rose expressed interest in a Lalique vase and asked Mr. Gaunt, who was nearby but did not hover, all noted with approval, how much it was. How much do you think? He asked, smiling. She smiled back at him rather coquettishly. Oh, she said, is that the way you do things, Mr. Gaunt? That's the way I do them, he agreed. Well, you're apt to lose more than you gain, dickering with Yankees, Cindy Rose said, while her friends looked on with the bright interest of spectators at a Wimbledon championship match. That, he said, remains to be seen. His voice was still friendly, but now it was mildly challenging as well. Cindy Rose looked more closely at the vase this time. Steffi Bonsaint whispered something in her ear. Cindy Rose nodded. $17, she said. The vase actually looked as if it might be worth 50, and she guessed that in a Boston antique shop it would be priced at 180. Gaunt steepled his fingers under his chin in a gesture Brian Rusk would have recognized. I think I'd have to have at least 45, he said with some regret. Cindy Rose's eyes brightened. There were possibilities here. She had originally seen the Lalique vase as something only mildly interesting, really not much more than another conversational crowbar to use on the mysterious Mr. Gaunt. Now she looked at it more closely and saw that it really was a nice piece of work, one which would look right at home in her living room. The border of flowers around the long neck of the vase was the exact color of her wallpaper. Until Gaunt had responded to her suggestion with a price which was only a finger's length out of her reach, she hadn't realized that she wanted the vase as badly as she now felt that she did. She consulted with her friends. Gaunt watched them, smiling gently. The bell over the door rang, and two more ladies came in. At Needful Things, the first full day of business had begun. When the Ash Street Bridge Club left Needful Things 10 minutes later, Cindy Rose Martin carried a shopping bag by the handles. Inside was the Lalique vase, wrapped in tissue paper. She had purchased it for $31 plus tax, almost all of her pin money, but she was so delighted with it that she was almost purring. Usually she felt doubtful and a little ashamed of herself after such an impulse buy, certain that she had been cozened a little, if not cheated outright, but not today. This was one deal where she had come out on top. Mr. Gaunt had even asked her to come back, saying he had the twin of this vase and it would be arriving in a shipment later in the week, perhaps even tomorrow. This one would look lovely on the little table in her living room, but if she had two, she could put one on each end of the mantel, and that would be smashing. Her three friends also felt that she had done well, and although they were a little frustrated at having gotten so little of Mr. Gaunt's background, their opinion of him was, on the whole, quite high. He's got the most beautiful green eyes, Francie Pelletier said, a little dreamily. Were they green? Cindy Rose asked, a little startled. She herself had thought they were gray. I didn't notice. Late that afternoon, Rosalie Drake from You So-and-So stopped in Needful Things on her coffee break, accompanied by Polly's housekeeper, Nettie Cobb. There were several women browsing in the store, and in the rear corner, two boys from Castle County High were leafing through a cardboard carton of comic books and muttering excitedly to each other. It was amazing, they both agreed, how many of the items they needed to fill their respective collections were here. They only hoped the prices would not prove too high. It was impossible to tell without asking, because there were no price stickers on the plastic bags which held the comics. Rosalie and Polly said hello to Mr. Gaunt, and Gaunt asked Rosalie to thank Polly again for the cake. His eyes followed Nettie, who had wandered away after the introductions and was looking rather wistfully at a small collection of carnival glass. He left Rosalie studying the picture of Elvis next to the splinter of petrified wood from the Holy Land and walked over to Nettie. "Do you like carnival glass, Ms. Cobb?" he asked softly. She jumped a little. Nettie Cobb had the face and almost painfully shy manner of a woman made to jump at voices, no matter how soft and friendly, when they spoke from the general area of her elbow, and smiled at him nervously. "It's Mrs. Cobb, Mr. Gaunt, although my husband's been passed on for some time now." "I am sorry to hear it." "No need to be. It's been 14 years, long time. Yes, I have a little collection of carnival glass." She seemed almost to quiver, as a mouse might quiver at the approach of a cat. "Not that I could afford anything so nice as these pieces. Lovely they are, like things must look in heaven." "Well, I'll tell you something," he said. "I bought quite a lot of carnival glass when I got these, and they're not as expensive as you might think, and the others are much nicer. Would you like to come by tomorrow and have a look at them?" She jumped again and sidled away a step, as if he had suggested she might like to come by the next day so he could pinch her bottom a few times, perhaps until she cried. "Oh, I don't think. Thursday's my busy day, you know, at Polly's. We really have to turn the place out on Thursdays, you know." "Are you sure you can't drop by?" he coaxed. "Polly told me that you made the cake she brought this morning, Was it all right? Nettie asked nervously. Her eyes said she expected him to say, no, it was not all right, Nettie. It gave me cramps. It gave me the backdoor trots, in fact. And so I'm going to hurt you, Nettie. I'm going to drag you into the back room and twist your nipples until you holler, Uncle. It was wonderful, he said soothingly. It made me think of the cakes my mother used to make, and that was a very long time ago. This was the right note to strike with Nettie, who had loved her own mother dearly in spite of the beatings that lady had administered after her frequent nights out in the juke joints and gin mills. She relaxed a little. Well, that's fine then, she said. I'm awfully glad it was good. Of course, it was Polly's idea. She's just about the sweetest woman in the world. Yes, he said. After meeting her, I can believe that. He glanced at Rosalie Drake, but Rosalie was still browsing. He looked back at Nettie and said, I just felt I owed you a little something. Oh, no, Nettie said, alarmed all over again. You don't owe me a thing, not a single solitary thing, Mr. Gaunt. Please, come by. I can see you have an eye for carnival glass, and I could give you back Polly's cake box. Well, I suppose I could drop by on my break. Nettie's eyes said she could not believe what she was hearing from her own mouth. Wonderful, he said, and left her quickly before she could change her mind again. He walked over to the boys and asked them how they were doing. They hesitantly showed him several old issues of The Incredible Hulk and The X-Men. 5 minutes later, they went out with most of the comic books in their hands and expressions of stunned joy on their faces. The door had barely shut behind them when it opened again. Cora Rusk and Myra Evans strode in. They looked around, eyes as bright and avid as those of squirrels in nut-gathering season, and went immediately to the glass case containing the picture of Elvis. Cora and Myra bent over, cooing with interest, displaying bottoms which were easily 2 axe handles wide. Gaunt watched them, smiling. The bell over the door jingled again. The new arrival was as large as Cora Rusk, but Cora was fat and this woman looked strong, the way a lumberjack with a beer belly looks strong. A large white button had been pinned to her blouse. The red letters proclaimed, Casino Night, just for fun. The lady's face had all the charm of a snow shovel. Her hair, an unremarkable and lifeless shade of brown, was mostly covered by a kerchief which was knotted severely under her wide chin. She surveyed the interior of the store for a moment or two, her small, deep-set eyes flicking here and there, like the eyes of a gunslinger who surveys the interior of a saloon before pushing all the way through the batwing doors and starting to raise hell. Then she came in. Few of the women circulating among the displays gave her more than a glance, but Nettie Cobb looked up at the newcomer with an extraordinary expression of mingled dismay and hate. Then she scuttled away from the carnival glass. Her movement caught the newcomer's eye. She glanced at Nettie with a kind of massive contempt, then dismissed her. The bell over the door jingled as Nettie left the shop. Mr. Gaunt observed all this with great interest. He walked over to Rosalie and said, Mrs. Cobb has left without you, I'm afraid. Rosalie looked startled. Why? She began, and then her eyes settled on the newcomer with the Casino Night button pinned adamantly between her breasts. She was studying the Turkish rug hung on the wall with the fixed interest of an art student in a gallery. Her hands were planted on her vast hips. Oh, Rosalie said, excuse me, I really ought to go along. No love lost between those two, I'd say, Mr. Gaunt remarked. Rosalie smiled distractedly. Gaunt glanced at the woman in the kerchief again. Who is she? Rosalie wrinkled her nose. Wilma Jerzyk, she said. Excuse me, I really ought to catch up with Nettie. She's high-strung, you know. Of course, he said, and watched Rosalie out the door. To himself, he added, aren't we all? Then Cora Rusk was tapping him on the shoulder. How much is that picture of the king? She demanded. Leland Gaunt turned his dazzling smile upon her. Well, let's talk about it, he said. How much do you think it's worth? Castle Rock's newest port of commerce had been closed for nearly 2 hours when Alan Pangborn rolled slowly down Main Street toward the municipal building,
which housed the sheriff's office and the Castle Rock Police Department. He was behind the wheel of the ultimate unmarked car, a 1986 Ford Town and Country station wagon, the family car. He felt low and half drunk. He'd only had three beers, but they'd hit him hard. He glanced at Needful Things as he drove past, approving of the dark green canopy which jutted out over the street, just as Brian Rusk had done. He knew less about such things, having no relations who worked for the Dick Perry Siding and Door Company in South Paris, but he thought it did lend a certain touch of class to Main Street, where most shop owners had added false fronts and called it good. He didn't know yet what the new place sold, Hollywood, if she had gone over this morning as she had planned, but it looked to Alan like one of those cozy French restaurants where you took the girl of your dreams before trying to sweet-talk her into bed. The place slipped from his mind as soon as he passed it. He signaled left a block farther down and turned up the narrow passage between the squat brick block of the municipal building and the white clapboard water district building. This lane was marked Official Vehicles Only. The municipal building was shaped like an upside-down L, and there was a small parking lot in the angle formed by the two wings. Three of the slots were marked Sheriff's Office. Norris Ridgwick's bumbling old VW Beetle was parked in one of them. Alan parked in another, cut the headlights in the motor, reached for the door handle. The depression, which had been circling him ever since he left the Blue Door in Portland, circling the way wolves often circled campfires in the adventure stories he had read as a boy, suddenly fell upon him. He let go of the door handle and just sat behind the wheel of the station wagon, hoping it would pass. He had spent the day in Portland's district court, testifying for the prosecution in four straight trials. The district encompassed four counties, York, Cumberland, Oxford, Castle, and of all the lawmen who served in those counties, Alan Pangborn had the furthest to travel. The three district judges therefore tried as best they could to schedule his court cases in bunches, so he would have to make the trip only once or twice a month. This made it possible for him to actually spend some time in the county, which he had sworn to protect, instead of on the roads between Castle Rock and Portland, but it also meant that, after one of his court days, he felt like a high school kid stumbling out of the auditorium where he had just taken the scholastic aptitude tests. He should have known better than to drink on top of that, but Harry Cross and George Crompton had just been on their way down to the Blue Door, and they had insisted that Alan join them. There had been a good enough reason to do so, a string of clearly related burglaries which had occurred in all their areas. But the real reason he had gone was the one most bad decisions have in common. It had seemed like a good idea at the time. Now he sat behind the wheel of what had been the family car, reaping what he had sown of his own free will. His head ached gently. He felt more than a touch of nausea. But the depression was the worst. It was back with a vengeance. "Hello!" it cried merrily from its stronghold inside his head. "Here I am, Alan. Good to see you. Guess what? Here it is, end of a long, hard day, and Annie and Todd are still dead. Remember the Saturday afternoon when Todd spilled his milkshake on the front seat? Right under where your briefcase is now, wasn't it? And you shouted at him? Wow! Didn't forget that, did you? You did? Well, that's okay, Alan, because I'm here to remind you, and remind you, and remind you." He lifted his briefcase and looked fixedly at the seat. Yes, the stain was there, and yes, he had shouted at Todd. "Todd, why do you always have to be so clumsy?" Something like that, no big deal, but not the sort of thing you would ever say if you knew your kid had less than a month to live. It occurred to him that the beers weren't the real problem. It was this car, which had never been properly cleaned out. He had spent the day riding with the ghosts of his wife and his younger son. He leaned over and popped the glove compartment to get his citation book. Carrying that, even when he was headed down to Portland to spend the day testifying in court, was an unbreakable habit, and reached inside. His hand struck some tubular object, and it fell out onto the floor of the station wagon with a little thump. He put his citation book on top of his briefcase and then bent over to get whatever it was he had knocked out of the glove compartment. He held it up so it caught the glow of the arc sodium light and stared at it for a long time, feeling the old dreadful ache of loss and sorrow steal into him. Polly's arthritis was in her hands. His, it seemed, was in his heart, and who could say which of them had gotten the worst of it? The can had belonged to Todd, of course. Todd, who would have undoubtedly lived in the Auburn novelty shop if he had been allowed. The boy had been entranced with the cheap Jack Arcana sold there. Joy buzzers, sneezing powder, dribble glasses, soap that turned the user's hands to the color of volcanic ash, plastic dog turds. This thing is still here. 19 months they've been dead, and it's still here. How in hell did I miss it? Christ! Alan turned the round can over in his hands, remembering how the boy had pleaded to be allowed to buy this particular item with his allowance money, how Alan himself had demurred, quoting his own father's proverb, "The fool and his money soon parted," and how Annie had overruled him in her gentle way. "Listen to you, Mr. Amateur Magician, sounding like a Puritan. I love it. Where do you think he got this insane love of gags and tricks in the first place? No one in my family ever kept a framed picture of Houdini on the wall, believe me. Do you want to tell me you didn't buy a dribble glass or two in the hot wild days of your youth? That you wouldn't have just about died to own the old snake in the can of nuts trick if you'd come across one in a display case somewhere?" He, hemming and hawing, sounding more and more like a pompous stuffed shirt windbag. Finally, he had had to raise a hand to his mouth to hide a grin of embarrassment. Annie had seen it, however. Annie always did. That had been her gift, and more than once, it had been his salvation. Her sense of humor, and her sense of perspective as well, had always been better than his. Sharper. "Let him have it, Alan. He'll only be young once, and it is sort of funny." So he had. And 3 weeks after that, he spilled his milkshake on the seat, and 4 weeks after that, he was dead. They were both dead. Wow! Imagine that! Time surely does fly by, doesn't it, Alan? But don't worry. Don't worry, because I'll keep reminding you. Yes, sir, I'll keep reminding you, because that's my job, and I mean to do it. The can was labeled Tasty Munch Mixed Nuts. Alan twisted off the top, and 5 feet of compressed green snake leaped out, struck the windshield, and rebounded into his lap. Alan looked at it, heard his dead son's laughter inside his head, and began to cry. His weeping was undramatic, silent, and exhausted. It seemed that his tears had a lot in common with the possessions of his dead loved ones. You never got to the end of them. There were too many, and just when you started to relax and think that it was finally over, the joint was clean, you found one more, and one more, and one more. Why had he let Todd buy the goddamn thing? Why was it still in the goddamn glove compartment? And why had he taken the goddamn town and country wagon in the first place? He pulled his handkerchief out of his back pocket and mopped the tears from his face. Then, slowly, he jammed the snake, just cheap green crepe paper with a metal spring wound up inside it, back into the bogus mixed nuts can. He screwed on the top and bounced the can thoughtfully on his hand. Throw the goddamn thing away. But he didn't think he could do that. Not tonight, at least. He tossed the joke, the last one Todd had ever bought in what he considered the world's finest store, back into the glove compartment and slammed the hatch shut. Then he took hold of the door handle again, grabbed his briefcase, and got out. He breathed deeply of the early evening air, hoping it would help. It didn't. He could smell decomposed wood and chemicals, a charmless odor which drifted down regularly from the paper mills in Rumford, some 30 miles north. He would call Polly and ask her if he could come over, he decided. That would help a little. "A truer thought was never thunk," the voice of depression agreed energetically. "And by the way, Alan, do you remember how happy that snake made him? He tried it on everyone, just about scared Norris Ridgwick into a heart attack, and you laughed until you almost wet your pants. Remember? Wasn't he lively? Wasn't he great? And Annie, remember how she laughed when you told her? She was lively and great, too, wasn't she? Of course, she wasn't quite as lively at the very end. Not quite as great, either, but you didn't really notice, did you? Because you had your own fish to fry. The business with Thad Beaumont, for instance. You really couldn't get that off your mind. What happened at their house by the lake, and how, after it was all over, he used to get drunk and call you. And then his wife took the twins and left him. All of that added to the usual around-town stuff kept you pretty busy, didn't it? Too busy to see what was happening right at home. Too bad you didn't see it. If you had, why, they might still be alive. That's something you shouldn't forget either, and so I'll just keep reminding you.
and reminding you and reminding you. Okay? Okay.
There was a foot-long scratch along the side of the wagon, just above the gasoline port. Had that happened since Annie and Todd died? He couldn't really remember, and it didn't matter much anyway. He traced his fingers along it and reminded himself again to take the car to Sunny Sunoco and get it fixed. On the other hand, why bother? Why not just take the damn thing down to Harry Ford in Oxford and trade it in on something smaller? The mileage on it was still relatively low. He could probably get a decent trade-in. But Todd spilled his milkshake on the front seat, the voice in his head piped up indignantly. He did that when he was alive, Alan, old buddy. And Annie... Oh, shut up, he said. He reached the building, then paused. Parked close by, so close that the office door would have dented in its side if pulled all the way open, was a large red Cadillac Seville. He didn't need to look at the license plates to know what they were. Keaton won. He ran a hand thoughtfully over the car's smooth hide, then went in. Sheila Brigham was sitting in the glass-walled dispatcher's cubicle, reading People magazine and drinking a Yoo-Hoo. The combined sheriff's office, Castle Rock Police Department, was otherwise deserted except for Norris Ridgewick. Norris sat behind an old IBM electric typewriter, working on a report with the agonized, breathless concentration only Norris could bring to paperwork. He would stare fixedly at the machine, then abruptly lean forward like a man who has been punched in the belly, and hit the keys in a rattling burst. He remained in his hunched position long enough to read what he had written, then groaned softly. There was the click-rap, click-rap, click-rap sound of Norris using the IBM's correct tape to back over some error. He used one correct tape per week on the average, and then Norris would straighten up. There would be a pregnant pause, and then the cycle would repeat itself. After an hour or so of this, Norris would drop the finished report into Sheila's in basket. Once or twice a week, these reports were even intelligible. Norris looked up and smiled as Alan crossed the small bullpen area. Hi, boss. How's it going? Well, Portland's out of the way for another 2 or 3 weeks. Anything happen here? Nah, just the usual. You know, Alan, your eyes are red as hell. Have you been smoking that wacky tobacco again? Ha ha, Alan said sourly. I stopped for a couple of drinks with a couple of cops, then stared at people's high beams for 30 miles. You got your aspirin handy? Always, Norris said. You know that. Norris's bottom desk drawer contained his own private pharmacy. He opened it, rummaged, produced a giant-sized bottle of strawberry-flavored K-Epectate, stared at the label for a moment, shook his head, dropped it back into the drawer, and rummaged some more. At last, he produced a bottle of generic aspirin. I've got a little job for you, Alan said, taking the bottle and shaking two aspirins into his hand. A lot of white dust fell out with the pills, and he found himself wondering why generic aspirin always produced more dust than brand-name aspirin. He wondered further if he might be losing his mind. Ah, Alan, I got two more of these E9 boogers to do, and... Cool your jets. Alan went to the water cooler and pulled a paper cup from the cylinder screwed to the wall. Blub, 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 went the water cooler as he filled the cup. All you've got to do is cross the room and open the door I just came through. So simple, even a child could do it, right? What? Only don't forget to take your citation book, Alan said, and gulped the aspirin down. Norris Ridgewick immediately looked wary. Yours is right there on the desk, next to your briefcase. I know, and that's where it's going to stay, at least for tonight. Norris looked at him for a long time. Finally he asked, Buster? Alan nodded. Buster. He's parked in the goddamn crip space again. I told him last time I was through warning him about it. Castle Rock's head selectman, Danforth Keaton III, was referred to as Buster by all who knew him. But municipal employees who wanted to hold on to their jobs made sure to call him Dan or Mr. Keaton when he was around. Only Alan, who was an elected official, dared call him Buster to his face, and he had done it only twice, both times when he was very angry. He supposed he would do it again, however. Dan Buster Keaton was a man Alan Pangborn found it very easy to get angry at. Come on, Norris said. You do it, Alan, okay? Can't. I've got that appropriations meeting with the selectman next week. He hates me already, Norris said morbidly. I know he does. Buster hates everyone except his wife and his mother, Alan said, and I'm not so sure about his wife.
but the fact remains that I have warned him at least half a dozen times in the last month about parking in our one and only handicapped space, and now I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. No, I'm going to put my job where your mouth is. This is really mean, Alan. I'm sincere. Norris Ridgwick looked like an ad for When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Relax, Alan said. You put a $5 parking ticket on his windshield, he comes to me, and first he tells me to fire you. Norris moaned. I refuse. Then he tells me to tear up the ticket. I refuse that, too. Then, tomorrow noon, after he's had a chance to froth at the mouth about it for a while, I relent. And when I go into the next appropriations meeting, he owes me a favor. Yeah, but what does he owe me? Norris, do you want a new pulse radar gun or not? Well, and what about a fax machine? We've been talking about a fax machine for at least 2 years. Yes, the falsely cheerful voice in his mind cried. You started talking about it when Annie and Todd were still alive, Alan. Remember that? Remember when they were still alive? I guess, Norris said. He reached for his citation book with sadness and resignation writ large upon his face. Good man, Alan said with a heartiness he didn't feel. I'll be in my office for a while. He closed the door and dialed Polly's number. Hello, she asked, and he knew immediately that he would not tell her about the depression which had come over him with such smooth completeness. Polly had her own problems tonight. It had taken only that single word to tell him how it was with her. The L sounds in hello were lightly slurred. That only happened when she had taken a Percodan, or perhaps more than one, and she took a Percodan only when the pain was very bad. Although she had never come right out and said so, Alan had an idea she lived in terror of the day when the perks would stop working. How are you, pretty lady? He asked, leaning back in his chair and putting a hand over his eyes. The aspirin didn't seem to be doing much for his head. Maybe I should ask her for a perk, he thought. I'm all right. He heard the careful way she was speaking, going from one word to the next, like a woman using stepping stones to cross a small stream. How about you? You sound tired. Lawyers do that to me every time. He shelved the idea of going over to see her. She would say, of course, Alan, and she would be glad to see him, almost as glad as he would be to see her. But it would put more strain on her than she needed this evening. I think I'll go home and turn in early. Do you mind if I don't come by? No, honey, it might be a little better if you didn't, actually. Is it bad tonight? It's been worse, she said carefully. That's not what I asked. Not too bad, no. Your own voice says you're a liar, my dear, he thought. Good. What's the deal on that ultrasonic therapy you told me about? Find anything out? Well, it would be great if I could afford a month and a half in the Mayo Clinic, on spec, but I can't. And don't tell me you can, Alan, because I'm feeling a little too tired to call you a liar. I thought you said Boston Hospital. Next year, Polly said. They're going to run a clinic using ultrasound therapy next year. Maybe. There was a moment of silence, and he was about to say goodbye when she spoke again. This time her tone was a little brighter. I dropped by the new shop this morning. I had Nettie make a cake and took that. Pure orneriness, of course. Ladies don't take baked goods to openings. It's practically graven in stone. What's it like? What does he sell? A little bit of everything. If you put a gun to my head, I'd say it's a curios and collectibles shop, but it really defies description. You'll have to see it for yourself. Did you meet the owner? Mr. Leland Gaunt from Akron, Ohio, Polly said, and now Alan could actually hear the hint of a smile in her voice. He's going to be quite the heartthrob in Castle Rock's smart set this year. That's my prediction anyway. What did you make of him? When she spoke again, the smile in her voice came through even more clearly. Well, Alan, let me be honest. You're my darling, and I hope I'm yours, but you are, he said. His headache was lifting a little. He doubted if it was Norris Ridgwick's aspirin working this small miracle. But he made my heart go pity-pat, too, and you should have seen Rosalie and Nettie when they came back. Nettie? He took his feet off the desk and sat up. Nettie scared of her own shadow. Yes, but since Rosalie persuaded her to go down with her, you know the poor old dear won't go anywhere alone. I asked Nettie what she thought of Mr. Gaunt after I got home this afternoon. Alan, her poor old muddy eyes just lit up. He's got carnival glass, she said. Beautiful carnival glass. He even invited me to come back tomorrow and look at some more. I think it's the most she said to me all at once in about 4 years. So I said, wasn't that kind of him, Nettie? And she said, yes, and do you know what? I asked her what, of course, and Nettie said, and I just might go. Alan laughed loud and heartily. If Nettie's willing to go see him without a duenna, I ought to check him out. The guy must really be a charmer. Well, it's funny. He's not handsome, or at least not in a movie star way, but he's got the most gorgeous hazel eyes. They light up his whole face.
Watch it, lady, Alan growled. My jealous muscle is starting to twitch.
She laughed a little. I don't think you have to worry. There's one other thing, though.
What's that?
Rosalie said Wilma Jurczyk came in while Nettie was there.
Did anything happen? Were words passed?
No. Nettie glared at the Jurczyk woman, and she kind of curled her lip at Nettie, that's how Rosalie put it, and then Nettie scurried out. Has Wilma Jurczyk called you about Nettie's dog lately?
No, Alan said. No reason to.
I've cruised past Nettie's house after 10 half a dozen nights over the last 6 weeks or so. The dog doesn't bark anymore. It was just the kind of thing puppies do, Polly. It's grown up a little, and it has a good mistress. Nettie may be short a little furniture on the top floor, but she's done her duty by that dog. What does she call it?
Raider.
Well, Wilma Jurczyk will just have to find something else to bitch about because Raider is squared away. She will, though. Ladies like Wilma always do. It was never the dog anyway, not really. Wilma was the only person in the whole neighborhood who complained. It was Nettie. People like Wilma have noses for weakness, and there's a lot to smell on Nettie Cobb.
Yes.
Polly sounded sad and thoughtful. You know that Wilma Jurczyk called her up one night and told her that if Nettie didn't shut the dog up, she'd come over and cut its throat.
Well, Alan said evenly, I know that Nettie told you so, but I also know that Wilma frightened Nettie very badly, and that Nettie has had problems. I'm not saying Wilma Jurczyk isn't capable of making a call like that, because she is, but it might have only been in Nettie's mind. That Nettie had had problems was understating by quite a little bit, but there was no need to say more. They both knew what they were talking about. After years of hell, married to a brute who abused her in every way a man can abuse a woman, Nettie Cobb had put a meat fork in her husband's throat as he slept. She had spent 5 years in Juniper Hill, a mental institution near Augusta. She had come to work for Polly as part of a work release program. As far as Alan was concerned, she could not possibly have fallen in with better company, and Nettie's steadily improving state of mind confirmed his opinion. 2 years ago, Nettie had moved into her own little place on Ford Street, 6 blocks from downtown.
Nettie's got problems, all right, Polly said, but her reaction to Mr. Gaunt was nothing short of amazing. It really was awfully sweet.
I do have to get in and see this guy for myself, Alan said.
Tell me what you think. And check out those hazel eyes.
I doubt if they'll cause the same reaction in me that they seem to have caused in you, Alan said dryly.
She laughed again, but this time he thought it sounded slightly forced.
Try to get some sleep, he said.
I will. Thanks for calling, Alan.
Welcome. He paused. I love you, pretty lady.
Thank you, Alan. I love you, too. Good night.
Good night.
He racked the telephone, twisted the gooseneck of the desk lamp so it threw a spot of light on the wall, put his feet up on his desk, and brought his hands together in front of his chest as if praying. He extended his index fingers. On the wall, a shadow rabbit poked up its ears. Alan slipped his thumbs between his extended fingers, and the shadow rabbit wiggled its nose. Alan made the rabbit hop across the makeshift spotlight. What lumbered back was an elephant wagging its trunk. Alan's hands moved with a dexterous, eerie ease. He barely noticed the animals he was creating. This was an old habit with him, his way of looking at the tip of his nose and saying om. He was thinking about Polly. Polly and her poor hands. What to do about Polly? If it had been just a matter of money, he would have had her checked into a room at the Mayo Clinic by tomorrow afternoon, signed, sealed, and delivered. He would have done it, even if it meant wrapping her in a straitjacket and shooting her full of sedative to get her out there. But it wasn't just a matter of money. Ultrasound as a treatment for degenerative arthritis was in its infancy. It might eventually turn out to be as effective as the Salk vaccine, or as bogus as the science of phrenology. Either way, it didn't make sense right now. The chances were 1,000 to 1 that it was a dry hole.
It was not the loss of money he dreaded, but Polly's dashed hopes. A crow, as limber and lifelike as a crow in a Disney animated cartoon, flapped slowly across his framed Albany Police Academy graduation certificate. Its wings lengthened, and it became a prehistoric pterodactyl, triangular head cocked as it cruised toward the filing cabinets in the corner and out of the spotlight. The door opened. The doleful basset hound face of Norris Ridgwick poked through. "I did it, Alan," he said, sounding like a man confessing to the murder of several small children. "Good, Norris," Alan said. "You're not going to get hit with the shit on this either. I promise." Norris looked at him for a moment longer with his moist eyes, then nodded doubtfully. He glanced at the wall. "Do Buster, Alan." Alan grinned, shook his head, and reached for the lamp. "Come on," Norris coaxed. "I ticketed his damn car. I deserve it. Do Buster, Alan. Please, that wipes me out." Alan glanced over Norris's shoulder, saw no one, and curled one hand against the other. On the wall, a stout shadow man stalked across the spotlight, belly swinging. He paused once to hitch up his shadow pants in the back and then stalked on, head turning truculently from side to side. Norris's laughter was high and happy, the laughter of a child. For one moment, Alan was reminded forcibly of Todd, and then he shoved that away. There had been enough of that for one night, please God.
"Jeez, that slays me," Norris said, still laughing. "You were born too late, Alan. You could have had a career on the Ed Sullivan Show."
"Go on," Alan said. "Get out of here."
Still laughing, Norris pulled the door closed. Alan made Norris, skinny and a little self-important, walk across the wall, then snapped off the lamp and took a battered notebook from his back pocket. He thumbed through it until he found a blank page and wrote, "Needful things." Below that, he jotted, "Leland Gaunt, Cleveland, Ohio." Was that right? No. He scratched out Cleveland and wrote, "Akron." Maybe I really am losing my mind, he thought. On a third line, he printed, "Check it out." He put his notebook back in his pocket, thought about going home, and turned on the lamp again instead. Soon the shadow parade was marching across the wall once more. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Like Sandberg's fog, the depression crept back on small, feline feet. The voice began speaking about Annie and Todd again. After a while, Alan Pangborn began to listen to it. He did it against his will, but with growing absorption. Polly was lying on her bed, and when she finished talking with Alan, she turned over on her left side to hang up the telephone. It fell out of her hand and crashed to the floor instead. The princess phone's base slid slowly across the night table, obviously meaning to join its other half. She reached for it, and her hand struck the edge of the table instead. A monstrous bolt of pain broke through the thin web the painkiller had stretched over her nerves and raced all the way up to her shoulder. She had to bite down on her lips to stifle a cry. The telephone base fell off the edge of the table and crashed with a single cling of the bell inside. She could hear the steady idiot buzz of the open line drifting up. It sounded like a hive of insects being broadcast via short wave. She thought of picking the telephone up with the claws which were now cradled on her chest, having to do it not by grasping, tonight her fingers would not bend at all, but by pressing, like a woman playing the accordion, and suddenly it was too much. Even something as simple as picking up a telephone which had fallen on the floor was too much, and she began to cry. The pain was fully awake again, awake and raving, turning her hands, especially the one she had bumped, into fever pits. She lay on her bed, looking up at the ceiling through her blurry eyes and wept. "Oh, I would give anything to be free of this," she thought. "I would give anything, anything, anything at all." By 10 o'clock on an autumn weeknight, Castle Rock's main street was as tightly locked up as a Chubb safe. The street lamps threw circles of white light on the sidewalk and the fronts of the business buildings in diminishing perspective, making downtown look like a deserted stage set. Soon, you might think, a lone figure dressed in tails and a top hat, Fred Astaire or maybe Gene Kelly, would appear and dance his way from one of those spots to the next, singing about how lonely a fellow could be when his best girl had given him the air and all the bars were closed. Then, from the other end of Main Street, another figure would appear, Ginger Rogers or maybe Sid Charisse, dressed in an evening gown. She would dance toward Fred, or Jean, singing about how lonely a gal could be when her best guy had stood her up. They would see each other, pause artistically, and then dance together in front of the bank, or maybe you so-and-so. Instead, Hugh Priest hove into view. He did not look like either Fred Astaire or Jean Kelly. There was no girl at the far end of Main Street advancing toward a romantic chance meeting with him, and he most definitely did not dance. He did drink, however, and he had been drinking steadily in the Mellow Tiger since 4 that afternoon. At this point in the festivities, just walking was a trick, and never mind any fancy dance steps. He walked slowly, passing through one pool of light after another, his shadow running tall across the fronts of the barber shop, the Western Auto, the video rental shop. He was weaving slightly, his reddish eyes fixed stolidly in front of him, his large belly pushing out his sweaty blue T-shirt. On the front was a drawing of a huge mosquito above the words Maine State Bird, in a long, sloping curve. The Castle Rock Public Works pickup truck he had been driving was still sitting at the rear of the Tiger's dirt parking lot. Hugh Priest was the not-so-proud possessor of several OUI driving violations, and following the last one, which had resulted in a 6-month suspension of his privilege to drive, that bastard Keaton, his co-bastards Fullerton and Samuels, and their co-bitch Williams, Castle Rock's fourth selectman was actually a select woman, had made it clear that they had reached the end of their patience with him. The next OUI would probably result in the permanent loss of his license, and would certainly result in the loss of his job. This did not cause Hugh to stop drinking. No power on earth could do that, but it did cause him to form a firm resolution. No more drinking and driving. He was 51 years old, and that was a little late in life to be changing jobs, especially with a long drunk driving rap sheet following him around like a tin can tied to a dog's tail. That was why he was walking home tonight, and one fuck of a long walk it was, and there was a certain Public Works employee named Bobby Dugas who was going to have some tall explaining to do tomorrow, unless he wanted to go home with a few less teeth than he had come to work with. As Hugh passed Nan's luncheonette, a light drizzle began to mist down. This did not improve his temper. He had asked Bobby, who had to drive right past Hugh's place on his way home every night, if he was going to drop down to the Tiger that evening for a few brewskis. Bobby Dugas had said, "Why, sure, Hubert." Bobby always called him Hubert, which was not his fucking name, and you could bet that shit was going to change too, and soon. "Why, sure, Hubert, I'll probably be down there around 7, same as always." So Hugh, confident of a ride if he got a little too pixelated to drive, had pulled into the Tiger at just about 4:05. He'd knocked off a little early, almost an hour and a half early, actually, but what the hell, Deke Bradford hadn't been around, and had waded right in. And come 7:00, guess what? No Bobby Dugas. Golly gosh, wow. Come 8 and 9 and 9:30, guess further what? More of the same, by God. At 9:40, Henry Beaufort, bartender and owner of the Mellow Tiger, had invited Hugh to put an egg in his shoe and beat it, to make like a tree and leave, to imitate an amoeba and split, in other words, to get the fuck out. Hugh had been outraged. It was true he had kicked the jukebox, but the goddamn George Jones record had been skipping again. "What was I supposed to do, just sit here and listen to it?" he demanded of Henry. "You ought to take that record off, that's all. Guy sounds like he's having a fucking epileptic fit." "You haven't had enough, I can see that," Henry said, "but you've had all you're going to get here. You'll have to get the rest of it out of your own refrigerator." "What if I say no?" Hugh demanded. "Then I call Sheriff Pangborn," Henry said evenly. The other patrons of the Tiger, there weren't many this late on a weeknight, were watching this exchange with interest. Men were careful to be polite around Hugh Priest, especially when he was in his cups, but he was never going to win Castle Rock's most popular fella contest. "I wouldn't like to," Henry continued, "but I will do it, Hugh. I'm sick and tired of you kicking my rockola." Hugh considered saying, "Then I guess I'll just have to kick you a few times instead, you frog son of a bitch." Then he thought of that fat bastard Keaton handing him a pink slip for kicking up Dickens in the local tavern. Of course, if he really got fired, the pink would come in the mail. It always did. Pigs like Keaton never dirtied their hands or risked a fat lip by doing it in person, but it helped to think of that. It turned the dials down a little. And he did have a couple of six-packs at home, one in the fridge and the other in the woodshed.
Okay, he said. I don't need this action anyway. Give me my keys.
For he had turned them over to Henry as a precaution when he sat down at the bar 6 hours and 18 beers ago.
Nope. Henry wiped his hands on a piece of towel and stared at Hugh unflinchingly.
Nope.
What the hell you mean,
nope?
I mean you're too damn drunk to drive. I know it. When you wake up tomorrow morning and see how your head feels, you're going to know it too.
Listen, Hugh said patiently. When I gave you the goddamn keys, I thought I had a ride home. Bobby Duga said he was coming down for a few beers. It's not my fault the numb fuck never showed.
Henry sighed. I sympathize with that, but it's not my problem. I could get sued if you wiped somebody out. I doubt if that means much to you, but it does to me. I got to cover my ass, buddy. In this world, nobody else does it for you.
Hugh felt resentment, self-pity, and an odd, inchoate wretchedness welled to the surface of his mind like some foul liquid seeping up from a long-buried canister of toxic waste. He looked from his keys, hanging behind the bar next to a plaque which read, "If you don't like our town, look for a timetable," and back to Henry. He was alarmed to find he was on the verge of tears. Henry glanced past him at the few other customers currently in attendance.
"Hey, any of you yo-yos headed up Castle Hill?"
Men looked down at their tables and said nothing. One or two cracked their knuckles. Charlie Fortin sauntered toward the men's room with elaborate slowness. No one answered.
"See?" Hugh said. "Come on, Henry. Give me my keys."
Henry had shaken his head with slow finality. "If you want to come in here and do some drinking another time, you just want to take a hike."
"Okay, I will," Hugh said.
His voice was that of a pouty child on the verge of a temper tantrum. He crossed the floor with his head down and his hands balled into tight fists. He waited for someone to laugh. He almost hoped someone would. He would clean some house then and fuck the job. But the place was silent except for Reba McIntyre, who was whining something about Alabama.
"You can pick up your keys tomorrow," Henry called after him.
Hugh said nothing. With a mighty effort, he restrained himself from putting one scuffed yellow work boot right through Henry Beaufort's damned old rockola as he went by. Then, with his head down, he passed out into darkness. Now the mist had become a proper drizzle, and Henry guessed the drizzle would develop into a steady, drenching rain by the time he reached home. It was just his luck. He walked steadily onward, not weaving quite so much now. The air had had a sobering effect on him, eyes moving restlessly from side to side. His mind was troubled, and he wished someone would come along and give him some lip. Even a little lip would do tonight. He thought briefly of the kid who had stepped in front of his truck yesterday afternoon and wished sulkily that he had knocked the brat all the way across the street. It wouldn't have been his fault, no way. In his day, kids had looked where they were going. He passed the vacant lot where the Emporium Galorium had stood before it burned down, You So-and-So, Castle Rock Hardware, and then he was passing Needful Things. He glanced into the display window, looked back up Main Street, only a mile and a half to go now, and maybe he would beat the rain before it really started to pelt down after all, and then came to a sudden halt. His feet had carried him past the new store, and he had to go back. There was a single light on above the window display, casting its soft glow down over the three items arranged there. The light also spilled out onto his face, and it worked a wondrous transformation there. Suddenly Hugh looked like a tired little boy up long past his bedtime, a little boy who has just seen what he wants for Christmas, what he must have for Christmas, because all at once nothing else on God's green earth would do. The central object in the window was flanked by two fluted vases, Nettie Cobb's beloved carnival glass, although Hugh didn't know this and would not have cared if he did. It was a foxtail. Suddenly it was 1955 again. He had just gotten his license, and he was driving to the Western Maine Schoolboy Championship game, Castle Rock versus Oxford Hills, in his dad's 53 Ford convertible. It was an unseasonably warm November day, warm enough to pull that old rag top down and tack the tarp over it, if you were a bunch of hot-blooded kids ready, willing, and able to raise some hell, that was, and there were six of them in the car.
Peter Doyon had brought a flask of log cabin whiskey. Perry Como was on the radio. Hugh Priest was sitting behind the white wheel, and fluttering from the radio antenna had been a long, luxuriant foxtail, just like the one he was now looking at in the window of this store. He remembered looking up at that fluttering foxtail and thinking that when he owned a convertible of his own, he was going to have one just like that. He remembered refusing the flask when it came around to him. He was driving, and you didn't drink while you were driving, because you were responsible for the lives of others. And he remembered one other thing as well, the certainty that he was living the best hour of the best day of his life. The memory surprised and hurt him in its clarity and total sensory recall. Smoky aroma of burning leaves, November sun twinkling on guardrail reflectors. And now, looking at the foxtail in the display window of Needful Things, it struck him that it had been the best day of his life, one of the last days before the booze had caught him firmly in its rubbery, pliant grip, turning him into a weird variation of King Midas. Everything he had touched since then, it seemed, had turned to shit. He suddenly thought, I could change. This idea had its own arresting clarity. I could start over. Were such things possible? Yes, I think sometimes they are. I could buy that foxtail and tie it on the antenna of my Buick. They'd laugh, though. The guys would laugh. What guys? Henry Beaufort? That little pissant Bobby Dugas? So what? Fuck 'em. Buy that foxtail, tie it to the antenna, and drive.
Drive where?
Well, how about that Thursday night AA meeting over in South Paris, for start? For a moment, the possibility stunned and excited him, the way a long-term prisoner might be stunned and excited by the sight of the key left in the lock of his jail cell by a careless warder. For a moment, he could actually see himself doing it, picking up a white chip, then a red chip, then a blue chip, getting sober day by day and month by month. No more Mellow Tiger, too bad, but also no more payday spent in terror that he would find a pink slip in his envelope along with his check, and that was not so too bad. In that moment, as he stood looking at the foxtail in the display window of Needful Things, Hugh could see a future. For the first time in years, he could see a future, and that beautiful orange fox brush with its white tip floated through it like a battle flag. Then reality crashed back in, and reality smelled like rain and damp, dirty clothes. It would be no foxtail for him, no AA meetings, no chips, no future. He was 51 fucking years old, and 51 was too old for dreams of the future. At 51, you had to keep running just to escape the avalanche of your own past. If it had been business hours, though, he would have taken a shot at it anyway. Damned if he wouldn't. He'd walk in there, just as big as Billy be damned, and ask how much was that foxtail in the window. But it was 10 o'clock, Main Street was locked up as tight as an Ice Queen's chastity belt, and when he woke up tomorrow morning, feeling as if someone had placed an ice pick between his eyes, he would have forgotten all about that lovely foxtail with its vibrant russet color. Still, he lingered a moment longer, trailing dirty, calloused fingers over the glass like a kid looking into a toy shop window. A little smile had touched the corners of his mouth. It was a gentle smile, and it looked out of place on Hugh Priest's face. Then, somewhere up on Castle View, a car backed off several times, sounds as sharp as shotgun blasts on the rainy air, and Hugh was startled back to himself. Fuck it. What the hell are you thinking of? He turned away from the window and pointed his face toward home again, if you wanted to call the two-room shack with the tacked-on woodshed where he lived home. As he passed under the canopy, he looked at the door and stopped again. The sign there, of course, read, Open. Like a man in a dream, Hugh put his hand out and tried the knob. It turned freely under his hand. Overhead, a small silver bell tinkled. The sound seemed to come from an impossible distance away. A man was standing in the middle of the shop. He was running a feather duster over the top of a display case and humming. He turned toward Hugh when the bell rang. He didn't seem a bit surprised to see someone standing in his doorway at 10 minutes past 10 on a Wednesday night. The only thing that struck Hugh about the man in that confused moment was his eyes. They were as black as an Indian's. You forgot to turn your sign over, buddy, Hugh heard himself say. No, indeed, the man replied politely. I don't sleep well, I'm afraid, and some nights I take a fancy to open late.
One never knows when a fellow such as yourself may stop by and take a fancy to something. Would you like to come in and look around? Hugh Priest came in and closed the door behind him.
There's a fox tail,
Hugh began, and then had to stop, clear his throat, and start again. The words had come out in a husky, unintelligible mutter. There's a fox tail in the window.
Yes, the proprietor said. Beauty, isn't it?
He held the duster in front of him now, and his Indian black eyes looked at Hugh with interest from above the bouquet of feathers which hid his lower face. Hugh couldn't see the guy's mouth, but he had an idea he was smiling. It usually made him uneasy when people, especially people he didn't know, smiled at him. It made him feel like he wanted to fight. Tonight, however, it didn't seem to bother him at all, maybe because he was still half-shot.
It is, Hugh agreed. It is a beauty. My dad had a convertible with a fox tail just like that, tied to the antenna, back when I was a kid. There's a lot of people in this crummy little burg wouldn't believe I ever was a kid, but I was. Same as everyone else.
Of course. The man's eyes remained fixed on Hugh's, and the strangest thing was happening. They seemed to be growing. Hugh couldn't seem to pull his own eyes away from them. Too much direct eye contact was another thing which usually made him feel like he wanted to fight, but this also seemed perfectly okay tonight.
I used to think that foxtail was just about the coolest thing in the world.
Of course.
Cool. That was the word we used back then. None of this rad shit. And gnarly. I don't have the slightest fucking idea what that means, do you?
But the proprietor of Needful Things was silent, simply standing there, watching Hugh Priest with his black Indian eyes over the foliage of his feather duster.
Anyway, I want to buy it. Will you sell it to me?
Of course, Leland Gaunt said for the third time. Hugh felt relief and a sudden, sprawling happiness. He was suddenly sure that everything was going to be all right. Everything. This was utterly crazy. He owed money to just about everyone in Castle Rock and the surrounding three towns. He had been on the ragged edge of losing his job for the last 6 months. His Buick was running on a wing and a prayer. But it was also undeniable.
How much? He asked.
He suddenly wondered if he would be able to afford such a fine brush and felt a touch of panic. What if it was out of his reach? Worse, what if he scrounged up the money somehow tomorrow, or the day after that, only to find that the guy had sold it?
Well,
that depends.
Depends? Depends on what?
On how much you're willing to pay. Like a man in a dream, Hugh pulled his battered Lord Buxton out of his back pocket.
Put that away, Hugh.
Did I tell him my name? Did I? Hugh couldn't remember, but he put his wallet away. Turn out your pockets, right here, on top of this case. Hugh turned out his pockets. He put his pocket knife, a roll of certs, his Zippo lighter, and about $1.50 in tobacco-sprinkled change on top of the case. The coins clicked on the glass. The man bent forward and looked at the pile. That looks about right, he remarked, and brushed the feather duster over the meager pile. When he removed it again, the knife, the lighter, and the certs were still there. The coins were gone. Hugh observed this with no surprise at all. He stood as silently as a toy with dead batteries while the tall man went to the display window and came back with the fox brush. He laid it on top of the cabinet beside Hugh's shrunken pile of pocket paraphernalia. Slowly, Hugh stretched out one hand and stroked the fur. It felt cold and rich. It crackled with silky static electricity. Stroking it was like stroking a clear autumn night.
Nice? The tall man asked.
Nice, Hugh agreed distantly, and made to pick up the foxtail. Don't do that, the tall man said sharply, and Hugh's hand fell away at once. He looked at Gaunt with a hurt so deep it was grief. We're not done dickering yet.
No, Hugh agreed.
I'm hypnotized, he thought. Damned if the guy hasn't hypnotized me. But it didn't matter. It was, in fact, sort of nice. He reached for his wallet again, moving as slowly as a man underwater.
Leave that alone, you ass, Mr. Gaunt said impatiently, and laid his feather duster aside.
Hugh's hand dropped to his side again. Why is it that so many people think all the answers are in their wallets? The man asked querulously. I don't know, Hugh said. He had never considered the idea before. It does seem a little silly.
Worse, Gaunt snapped. His voice had taken on the nagging, slightly uneven cadences of a man who was either very tired or very angry. He was tired. It had been a long, demanding day. Much had been accomplished, but the work was still just barely begun. It's much worse. It's criminally stupid. Do you know something, Hugh? The world is full of needy people who don't understand that everything is for sale, if you're willing to pay the price. They give lip service to the concept, that's all, and pride themselves on their healthy cynicism. Well, lip service is bourgeois, absolute bourgeois.
Bourgeois, Hugh agreed mechanically. For the things people really need, Hugh, the wallet is no answer. The fattest wallet in this town isn't worth the sweat from a working man's armpit. Absolute bourgeois. And souls. If I had a nickel, Hugh, for every time I ever heard someone say, I'd sell my soul for thus and such, I could buy the empire, state, building. He leaned closer, and now his lips stretched back from his uneven teeth in a huge, unhealthy grin. Tell me this, Hugh, What in the name of all the beasts crawling under the earth would I want with your soul?
Probably nothing.
His voice seemed far away. His voice seemed to be coming from the bottom of a deep, dark cave. I don't think it's in very good shape these days.
Mr. Gaunt suddenly relaxed and straightened up. Enough of these lies and half-truths. Hugh, do you know a woman named Nettie Cobb?
Crazy Nettie? Everyone in town knows Crazy Nettie. She killed her husband.
I know. Now listen to me, Hugh. Listen carefully. Then you can take your foxtail and go home.
Hugh Priest listened carefully. Outside, it was raining harder, and the wind had begun to blow.
Brian, Miss Ratcliffe said sharply. Why, Brian Rusk, I wouldn't have believed it of you. Come up here, right now.
He was sitting in the back row of the basement room where the speech therapy classes were held, and he had done something wrong. Terribly wrong by the sound of Miss Ratcliffe's voice, but he didn't know what it was until he stood up. Then he saw he was naked. A horrible wave of shame swept over him, but he felt excited, too. When he looked down at his penis and saw it starting to stiffen, he felt both alarmed and thrilled.
Come up here, I said.
He advanced slowly to the front of the room while the others, Sally Myers, Donnie Frankel, Noni Martin, and poor old half-bright Slopey Dodd, goggled at him. Miss Ratcliffe stood in front of her desk, hands on hips, eyes blazing, a gorgeous cloud of dark auburn hair floating around her head. You're a bad boy, Brian. A very bad boy. He nodded his head dumbly, but his penis was raising its head, and so it seemed there was at least one part of him that did not mind being bad at all, that in fact relished being bad. She put a piece of chalk in his hand. He felt a small bolt of electricity when their hands touched. Now, Miss Ratcliffe said severely. You must write, I will finish paying for my Sandy Koufax card 500 times on the blackboard.
Yes, Miss Ratcliffe.
He began to write, standing on tiptoe to reach the top of the board, aware of warm air on his naked buttocks. He had finished, I will finish paying, when he felt Miss Ratcliffe's smooth, soft hand encircle his stiff penis and begin to tug on it gently. For a moment he thought he would faint dead away, it felt so good. Keep writing, she said grimly from behind him, and I'll keep on doing this.
Miss Ratcliffe, what about my tongue exercises? Asked Slopey Dodd.
Shut up, or I'll run you over in the parking lot, Slopey, Miss Ratcliffe said. I'll make you squeak, little buddy. She went on pulling Brian's pudding while she spoke. He was moaning now. It was wrong, he knew that, but it felt good. It felt most sincerely awesome. It felt like what he needed, just the thing. Then he turned around, and it wasn't Miss Ratcliffe standing at his shoulder, but Wilma Jerzyk, with her large, round, pallid face and her deep brown eyes, like two raisins pounded deep into a wad of dough.
He'll take it back if you don't pay, Wilma said. And that's not all, little buddy.
Brian Rusk woke up with such a jerk that he almost fell out of bed and onto the floor. His body was covered with sweat, His heart was pounding like a jackhammer, and his penis was a small, hard branch inside his pajama trousers. He sat up, shivering all over. His first impulse was to open his mouth and yell for his mother, as he had done when he was small and a nightmare had invaded his sleep. Then he realized that he wasn't small anymore. He was 11, and it wasn't exactly the sort of dream you told your mother about anyway, was it? He lay back, eyes wide and staring into the dark. He glanced at the digital clock on the table next to the bed and saw it was 4 minutes past midnight. He could hear the sound of rain, hard now, pelting against his bedroom window, driven by huge, whooping gasps of wind. It sounded almost like sleet. "My card, my Sandy Koufax card, is gone." It wasn't. He knew it wasn't, but he also knew he would not be able to go back to sleep until he'd checked to make sure it was still there, in the loose-leaf binder where he kept his growing collection of Topps cards from 1956. He had checked it before leaving for school yesterday, had done so again when he got home, and last night, after supper, he had broken off playing pass in the backyard with Stanley Dawson to check on it once more. He had told Stanley he had to go to the bathroom. He had peeked at it one final time before crawling into bed and turning out the light. He recognized that it had become a kind of obsession with him, but recognition did not put a stop to it. He slipped out of bed, barely noticing the way the cool air brought out goosebumps on his hot body and made his penis wilt. He walked quietly across to his dresser. He left the shape of his own body behind him on the sheet which covered his mattress, printed in sweat. The big book lay on top of the dresser in a pool of white light thrown by the street lamp outside. He took it down, opened it, and paged rapidly through the sheets of clear plastic with the pockets you put the cards in. He passed Mel Parnell, Whitey Ford, and Warren Spahn, treasures over which he had once gloated mightily, with hardly a glance. He had a moment of terrible panic when he reached the sheets at the back of the book, the ones which were still empty, without seeing Sandy Koufax. Then he realized he had turned several pages at once in his hurry. He turned back and, yes, there he was, that narrow face, those faintly smiling, dedicated eyes, looking out from beneath the bill of the cap. "To my good friend Brian, with best wishes, Sandy Koufax." His fingers traced over the sloping lines of the inscription. His lips moved. He felt at peace again, or almost at peace. The card wasn't really his yet. This was just sort of a trial run. There was something he had to do before it would really be his. Brian wasn't completely sure what it was, but he knew it had something to do with the dream from which he had just wakened, and he was confident that he would know when the time, tomorrow, later today, came. He closed the loose-leaf binder, Brian's collection, Do Not Touch, carefully printed on the file card, scotch-taped to the front, and returned it to the dresser. Then he went back to bed. Only one thing about having the Sandy Koufax card was troubling. He had wanted to show it to his father. Coming home from Needful Things, he had imagined just how it would be when he showed it to him. He, Brian, elaborately casual. "Hey, Dad, I picked up a 56 today at the new store. Want to check it out?" His dad would say okay, not really interested, just going along with Brian to his room to keep Brian happy. But how his eyes would light up when he saw what Brian had lucked into. And when he saw the inscription, yes, he would be amazed and delighted, all right. He'd probably clap Brian on the back and give him a high five. But then what? Then the questions would start. That was what. And that was the problem. His father would want to know, first, where he had gotten the card, and second, where he had gotten the money to buy such a card, which was A, rare, B, in excellent condition, and C, autographed. The printed signature on the card read Sanford Koufax, which was the fabled fastball pitcher's real name. The autographed signature read Sandy Koufax, and in the weird and sometimes high-priced world of baseball trading card collectors, that meant fair market value might be as much as $150. In his mind, Brian tried out one possible answer. "I got it at the new store, Dad, Needful Things. The guy gave it to me at a really wicked discount.
He said it'd make people more interested in coming to his store if they knew he kept his prices down. That was good as far as it went, but even a kid still a year too young to pay the full adult price of admission at the movies knew it didn't go far enough. When you said somebody had given you a really good deal on something, people were always interested. Too interested. Oh, yeah? How much did he knock off? 30%? 40? Did he give it to you for half price? That'd still be 60 or 70 bucks, Brian, and I know you don't have that kind of money just laying around in your piggy bank. Well, actually, it was a little less than that, Dad. Okay, tell me, how much did you pay? Well, 85 cents. He sold you a 1956 autographed Sandy Koufax baseball card in uncirculated condition for 85 cents? Yeah, that's where the real trouble would start, all right. What kind of trouble? He didn't know exactly, but there would be a stink, he was sure of that. Somehow he would get blamed, maybe by his dad, but by his mom for sure. They might even try to make him give it back, and there was no way he was going to give it back. It wasn't just signed, it was signed to Brian. No way. Hell, he hadn't even been able to show Stan Dawson when Stan came over to play pass, although he'd wanted to. Stan would have fudged his jockeys. But Stan was going to sleep over on Friday night, and it was all too easy for Brian to imagine him saying to Brian's dad, "So how'd you like Brian's Sandy Koufax card, Mr. Rusk? Pretty rad, huh?" The same went for his other friends. Brian had uncovered one of the great truths of small towns. Many secrets, in fact, all the really important secrets, cannot be shared. Because word has a way of getting around, and getting around fast. He found himself in a strange and uncomfortable position. He had come by a great thing and could not show or share it. This should have vitiated his pleasure in his new acquisition, and it did to some extent, but it also afforded him a furtive, niggardly satisfaction. He found himself not so much enjoying the card as gloating over it, and so he had uncovered another great truth. Gloating in private provides its own peculiar pleasure. It was as if one corner of his mostly open and good-hearted nature had been walled off and then lit with a special black light that both distorted and enhanced what was hidden there. And he was not going to give it up. No way. Negatory. "Then you better finish paying for it," a voice deep in his mind whispered. He would. No problem there. He didn't think the thing he was supposed to do was exactly nice, but he was pretty sure it wasn't anything totally gross either. Just a prank, a voice whispered in his mind. And he saw the eyes of Mr. Gaunt, dark blue, like the sea on a clear day, and strangely soothing. "That's all. Just a little prank." Yeah, just a prank, whatever it was. No problem. He settled deeper under his goose-down quilt, turned over on his side, closed his eyes, and immediately began to doze. Something occurred to him as he and his brother Sleep drew closer to each other, something Mr. Gaunt had said. "You will be a better advertisement than the local paper could ever think of being." Only, he couldn't show the wonderful card he had bought. If a little thought had made that obvious to him, an 11-year-old kid who wasn't even bright enough to keep out of Hugh Priest's way when he was crossing the street, shouldn't a smart guy like Mr. Gaunt have seen it too? Well, maybe, but maybe not. Grown-ups didn't think the same way as normal people, and besides, he had the card, didn't he? And it was in his book, right where it should be, wasn't it? The answer to both questions was yes, and so Brian let go of the whole thing and went back to sleep as the rain pelted against his window and the restless fall wind screamed in the angles beneath the eaves. The rain had stopped by daylight on Thursday, and by 10:30, when Polly looked out the front window of You So-and-So and saw Nettie Cobb, the clouds were beginning to break up. Nettie was carrying a rolled-up umbrella and went scuttling along Main Street with her purse clamped under her arm as if she sensed the jaws of some new storm opening just behind her. "How are your hands this morning, Polly?" Rosalie Drake asked. Polly sighed inwardly. She would have to field the same question, but more insistently put, from Alan that afternoon, she supposed. She had promised to meet him for coffee at Nan's luncheonette around 3. You couldn't fool the people who had known you for a long time. They saw the pallor of your face and the dark crescents below your eyes. More important, they saw the haunted look in the eyes. Much better today, thanks, she said. This was overstating the truth by more than a little. They were better, but much better? Uh-uh. I thought, with the rain and all, it's unpredictable what makes them hurt. That's the pure devil of it. But never mind that, Rosalie. Come quick and look out the window. I think we're about to witness a minor miracle. Rosalie joined Polly at the window in time to see the small, scuttling figure with the umbrella clutched tightly in one hand, possibly for use as a bludgeon, judging from the way it was now being held, approach the awning of Needful Things. Is that Nettie? Is it really? Rosalie almost gasped. It really is. My God, she's going in! But for a moment, it seemed that Rosalie's prediction had queered the deal. Nettie approached the door, then pulled back. She shifted the umbrella from hand to hand and looked at the facade of Needful Things, as if it were a snake which might bite her. Go on, Nettie, Polly said softly. Go for it, sweetie. The close sign must be in the window, Rosalie said. No, he's got another one that says Tuesdays and Thursdays by appointment only. I saw it when I came in this morning. Nettie was approaching the door again. She reached for the knob, then drew back again. God, this is killing me, Rosalie said. She told me she might come back, and I know how much she likes carnival glass, but I never really thought she'd go through with it. She asked me if it would be all right for her to leave the house on her break so she could come down to what she called that new place and pick up my cake box, Polly murmured. Rosalie nodded. That's our Nettie. She used to ask me for permission to use the John. I got an idea. Part of her was hoping I'd say no, that there was too much to do. But I think part of her wanted me to say yes, too. Polly's eyes never left the fierce, small-scale struggle going on less than 40 yards away. A mini-war between Nettie Cobb and Nettie Cobb. If she actually did go in, what a step forward that would be for her. Polly felt dull, hot pain in her hands, looked down, and saw she had been twisting them together. She forced them down to her sides. It's not the cake box or the carnival glass, Rosalie said. It's him. Polly glanced at her. Rosalie laughed and blushed a little. Oh, I don't mean Nettie's got the hots for him or anything like that, although she did look a little starry-eyed when I caught up with her outside. He was nice to her, Polly. That's all. Honest and nice. Lots of people are nice to her, Polly said. Alan goes out of his way to be kind to her, and she still shies away from him. Our Mr. Gaughan has got a special kind of nice, Rosalie said simply. And as if to prove this, they saw Nettie grasp the knob and turn it. She opened the door, and then only stood there on the sidewalk, clutching her umbrella, as if the shallow well of her resolve had been utterly exhausted. Polly felt a sudden certainty that Nettie would now pull the door closed again and hurry away. Her hands, arthritis or no arthritis, closed into loose fists. Go on, Nettie. Go on in. Take a chance. Rejoin the world. Then Nettie smiled, obviously in response to someone neither Polly nor Rosalie could see. She lowered the umbrella from its position across her chest and went inside. The door closed behind her. Polly turned to Rosalie and was touched to see that there were tears in her eyes. The two women looked at each other for a moment and then embraced, laughing. Way to go, Nettie, Rosalie said. 2 points for our side, Polly agreed, and the sun broke free of the clouds inside her head a good 2 hours before it would finally do so in the sky above Castle Rock. 15 minutes later, Nettie Cobb sat in one of the plush, high-backed chairs Gaunt had installed along one wall of his shop. Her umbrella and purse lay on the floor beside her, forgotten. Gaunt sat next to her, his hands holding hers, his sharp eyes locked on her vague ones. A carnival glass lampshade stood beside Polly Chalmers's cake container on one of the glass display cases. The lampshade was a moderately gorgeous thing and might have sold for $300 or better in a Boston antique shop. Nettie Cobb had, nevertheless, just purchased it for $10.40, all the money she had had in her purse when she entered the shop. Beautiful or not, it was, for the moment, as forgotten as her umbrella. A deed, she was saying now. She sounded like a woman talking in her sleep. She moved her hands slightly so as to grip Mr. Gaunt's more tightly. He returned her grip, and a little smile of pleasure touched her face. Yes, that's right. It's really just a small matter. You know Mr. Keaton, don't you?
Oh, yes, Nettie said. Ronald and his son Danforth. I know them both. Which do you mean?
The younger, Mr. Gaunt said, stroking her palms with his long thumbs. The nails were slightly yellow and quite long. The head selectman.
They call him Buster, behind his back,
Nettie said and giggled. It was a harsh sound, a little hysterical, but Leland Gaunt did not seem alarmed. On the contrary, the sound of Nettie's not-quite-right laughter seemed to please him.
They have ever since he was a little boy.
I want you to finish paying for your lampshade by playing a trick on Buster.
Trick?
Nettie looked vaguely alarmed. Gaunt smiled. Just a harmless prank, and he'll never know it was you. He'll think it was someone else.
Oh.
Nettie looked past Gaunt at the carnival glass lampshade, and for a moment something sharpened her gaze. Greed, perhaps, or just simple longing and pleasure.
Well,
it will be all right, Nettie. No one will ever know, and you'll have the lampshade.
Nettie spoke slowly and thoughtfully. My husband used to play tricks on me a lot. It might be fun to play one on someone else.
She looked back at him, but now the thing sharpening her gaze was alarm.
If it doesn't hurt him. I don't want to hurt him. I hurt my husband, you know.
It won't hurt him, Gaunt said softly, stroking Nettie's hands. It won't hurt him a bit. I just want you to put some things in his house.
How could I get in Buster's? Here.
He put something into her hand, a key. She closed her hand over it.
When?
Nettie asked. Her dreaming eyes had returned to the lampshade again.
Soon.
He released her hands and stood up. And now, Nettie, I really ought to put that beautiful lampshade into a box for you. Mrs. Martin is coming to look at some Lalique in... He glanced at his watch. Goodness, in 15 minutes... But I can't begin to tell you how glad I am that you decided to come in. Very few people appreciate the beauty of carnival glass these days. Most people are just dealers with cash registers for hearts. Nettie also stood and looked at the lampshade with the soft eyes of a woman who is in love. The agonized nervousness with which she had approached the shop had entirely disappeared. It is lovely, isn't it? Very lovely, Mr. Gaunt agreed warmly. And I can't tell you, can't even begin to express, how happy it makes me to know that it will have a good home, a place where someone will do more than dust it on Wednesday afternoons and then, after years of that, break it in a careless moment and sweep the pieces up and then drop them into the trash without a second thought. I'd never do that, Nettie cried. I know you wouldn't, Mr. Gaunt said. It's one of your charms, Netitia. Nettie looked at him, amazed. How did you know my name? I have a flair for them. I never forget a name or a face. He went through the curtain at the back of his shop. When he returned, he held a flat sheet of white cardboard in one hand and a large fluff of tissue paper in the other. He set the tissue paper down beside the cake container. It began at once to expand with secret little ticks and snaps into something which looked like a giant corsage, and began to fold the cardboard into a box exactly the right size for the lampshade. I know you'll be a fine custodian of the item you have purchased. That's why I sold it to you.
Really? I thought, Mr. Keaton, and the trick.
No, 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 Mr. Gaunt said, half laughing and half exasperated. Anyone will play a trick. People love to play tricks. But to place objects with people who love them, and need them. That is a different kettle of fish altogether. Sometimes, Netitia, I think that what I really sell is happiness. What do you think?
Well, Nettie said earnestly, I know you've made me happy, Mr. Gaunt. Very happy.
He exposed his crooked, jostling teeth in a wide smile.
Good. That's good.
Mr. Gaunt pushed the tissue paper corsage into the box, cradled the lampshade in its ticking whiteness, closed the box, and taped it shut with a flourish.
And here we are,
Another satisfied customer has found her needful thing. He held the box out to her. Nettie took it, and as her fingers touched his, she felt a shiver of revulsion, even though she had gripped them with great strength, even ardor, a few moments ago. But that interlude had already begun to seem hazy and unreal. He put the Tupperware cake container on top of the white box. She saw something inside the former.
"What's that?"
"A note for your employer," Gaunt said. Alarm rose to Nettie's face at once.
"Not about me."
"Good heavens, no," Gaunt said, laughing, and Nettie relaxed at once. When he was laughing, Mr. Gaunt was impossible to resist or distrust. "Take care of your lampshade, Natisha, and do come again."
"I will,"
Nettie said, and this could have been an answer to both admonitions, but she felt in her heart, that secret repository where needs and fears elbowed each other continuously, like uncomfortable passengers in a crowded subway car, that while she might come here again, the lampshade was the only thing she would ever buy in Needful Things. Yet, what of that? It was a beautiful thing, the sort of thing she had always wanted, the only thing she needed to complete her modest collection. She considered telling Mr. Gaunt that her husband might still be alive if he had not smashed a carnival glass lampshade much like this one 14 years ago, that it had been the last straw, the one which finally drove her over the edge. He had broken many of her bones during their years together, and she had let him live. Finally, he had broken something she really needed, and she had taken his life. She decided she did not have to tell Mr. Gaunt this. He looked like the sort of man who might already know.
"Polly! Polly! She's coming out!"
Polly left the dressmaker's dummy, where she had been slowly and carefully pinning up a hem, and hurried to the window. She and Rosalie stood side by side, watching as Nettie left Needful Things in a state which could only be described as heavily laden. Her purse was under one arm, her umbrella was under the other, and in her hands she held Polly's Tupperware cake container balanced atop a square white box.
"Maybe I better go help her," Rosalie said.
"No." Polly put out a hand and restrained her gently. "Better not. I think she'd only be embarrassed and fluttery." They watched Nettie walk up the street. She no longer scuttled, as if before the jaws of a storm. Now she seemed almost to drift.
"No," Polly thought. "No, that isn't quite right. It's more like floating."
Her mind suddenly made one of those odd connections which were almost like cross-references, and she burst out laughing. Rosalie looked at her, eyebrows raised.
"Share?"
"It's the look on her face," Polly said, watching Nettie cross Linden Street in slow, dreamy steps.
"What do you mean?"
"She looks like a woman who just got laid and had about 3 orgasms." Rosalie turned pink, looked at Nettie once more, and then screamed with laughter. Polly joined in. The two of them held each other and rocked back and forth, laughing wildly.
"Gee," Alan Pangborn said from the front of the store.
"Ladies laughing at not quite 10:45 in the morning. It's too early for champagne, so what is it?"
4,
Rosalie said, giggling madly. Tears were streaming down her cheeks.
"It looked more like 4 to me."
Then they were off again, rocking back and forth in each other's arms, howling with laughter, while Alan stood watching them with his hands in the pockets of his uniform pants, smiling quizzically. Norris Ridgwick arrived at the sheriff's office in his street clothes about 10 minutes before the noon whistle blew at the mill. He had the midshift from 12 until 9 p.m. right through the weekend, and that was just the way he liked it. Let somebody else clean up the messes on the highways and byways of Castle County after the bars closed at 1 o'clock. He could do it, had done it on many occasions, but he almost always puked his guts. He sometimes puked his guts even if the victims were up, walking around and yelling that they didn't have to take any fucking breathalyzer test. They knew their constitutional rights. Norris just had that kind of a stomach. Sheila Brigham liked to tease him by saying he was like Deputy Andy on that TV show, Twin Peaks, but Norris knew he wasn't. Deputy Andy cried when he saw dead people. Norris didn't cry, but he was apt to puke on them, the way he'd almost puked on Homer Gamage that time when he found Homer sprawled in a ditch out by Homeland Cemetery, beaten to death with his own artificial arm. Norris glanced at the roster, saw both Andy Clutterbuck and John LaPointe were out on patrol, then at the day watch board. Nothing there for him, which was also just the way he liked it. To make his day complete, this end of it at least, his second uniform had come back from the cleaners, on the day promised for once. That would save him a trip home to change. A note pinned to the dry cleaning bag read, "Hey Barney, you owe me $5.25. Do not stiff me, or you will be a sadder and wiser man when the sun goes down." It was signed, "Clut." Norris's good mood was unbroken even by the note's salutation. Sheila Brigham was the only person in the Castle Rock Sheriff's Office who thought of Norris as a Twin Peaks kind of guy. Norris had an idea she was the only person in the department, besides himself that was, who even watched the show. The other deputies, John LaPointe, Seat Thomas, Andy Clutterbuck, called him Barney, after the Don Knotts character on the old Andy Griffith show. This sometimes irritated him, but not today. 4 days of midshift, then 3 days off. A whole week of silk laid out before him. Life could sometimes be grand. He pulled a 5 and a 1 from his wallet and laid them on Clut's desk. "Hey, Clut, live a little," he jotted on the back of a report form, signed his name with a flourish, and left it by the money. Then he stripped the dry cleaning bag off the uniform and took it into the men's room. He whistled as he changed clothes, then waggled his eyebrows approvingly as he stared at his reflection in the mirror. He was squared away, by God. 100% squared away. The evildoers of Castle Rock had damned well better be on the lookout today, or... He caught movement behind him in the mirror, but before he could do more than begin to turn his head, he had been grabbed, spun around, and slammed into the tiles beside the urinals. His head bonked the wall, his cap fell off, and then he was looking into the round, flushed face of Danforth Keaton. "What in the hell do you think you're doing, Ridgewick?" he asked. Norris had forgotten all about the ticket he had slipped under the windshield wiper of Keaton's Cadillac the night before. Now it all came back to him. "Let go of me," he said. He tried for a tone of indignation, but his voice came out in a worried squeak. He felt his cheeks growing hot. Whenever he was angry or scared, and right now he was both, he blushed like a girl. Keaton, who overtopped Norris by 5 inches and outweighed him by 100 pounds, gave the deputy a harsh little shake and then didn't let go. He pulled the ticket out of his pocket and brandished it under Norris's nose. "Is this your name on this goddamn thing, or isn't it?" he demanded, as though Norris had already denied it. Norris Ridgewick knew perfectly well that it was his signature, rubber-stamped, but perfectly recognizable, and that the ticket had been pulled from his citation book. "You were parked in the crip space," he said, stepping away from the wall and rubbing the back of his head. Damned if he didn't think there was going to be a knot there. As his initial surprise, and Buster had jumped the living Jesus out of him, he couldn't deny that, abated, his anger grew. "The what?" "The handicap space," Norris shouted. "And furthermore, it was Alan himself who told me to write that ticket," he was about to continue, and then didn't. "Why give this fat pig the satisfaction of passing the buck? You've been told about it before, Danforth, and you know it." "What did you call me?" Danforth Keaton asked ominously. Red splotches the size of cabbage roses had grown on his cheeks and jowls. "That's a valid ticket," Norris said, ignoring this last, "and as far as I'm concerned, you better pay it. Why, you're lucky I don't cite you for assaulting a police officer as well." Danforth laughed. The sound banged flatly off the walls. "I don't see any police officer," he said. "I see a narrow piece of shit packaged to look like beef jerky." Norris bent over and picked up his hat. His guts were a roil of fear. Danforth Keaton was a bad enemy for a man to have. And his anger had deepened into fury. His hands trembled. He took a moment, nonetheless, to set his hat squarely on his head. "You can take this up with Alan if you want. I'm taking it up with you. But I'm done talking about it. Make sure you pay that within 30 days, Danforth, or we'll have to come and get you." Norris drew himself up to his full 5'6" and added, "We know where to find you." He started out. Keaton, his face now looking like sunset in a nuclear blast area, stepped forward to block his escape route. Norris stopped and leveled a finger at him. "If you touch me, I'll throw you in a cell, Buster. I mean it." "Okay, that's it," Keaton said in a queer, toneless voice. "That is it. You're fired. Take off that uniform and start looking for another job." "No," a voice said from behind him. And they both looked around. Alan Pangborn was standing in the men's room doorway. Keaton rolled his hands into fat, white fists. "You keep out of this." Alan walked in, letting the door swoosh slowly shut behind him. "No," he said. "I was the one that told Norris to write that ticket. I also told him I was going to forgive it before the appropriations meeting. It's a $5 ticket, Dan. What the hell got into you?" Alan's voice was puzzled. He felt puzzled. Buster had never been a sweet-natured man, not even at the best of times. But an outburst like this was overboard even for him. Since the end of the summer, the man had seemed ragged and always on edge. Alan had often heard the distant bellow of his voice when the selectmen were in committee meetings, and his eyes had taken on a look which was almost haunted. He wondered briefly if Keaton might be sick and decided that was a consideration for some later time. Right now, he had a moderately ugly situation on his hands. "Nothing got into me," Keaton said sulkily and smoothed back his hair. Norris took some satisfaction in noticing that Keaton's hands were also trembling. "I'm just good and goddamn tired of self-important pricks like this man here. I try to do a lot for this town. Hell, I accomplish a lot for this town. And I'm sick of the constant persecution." He paused a moment, his fat throat working, and then burst out, "He called me Buster. You know how I feel about that." "He'll apologize," Alan said calmly. "Won't you, Norris?"
"I don't know that I will," Norris said. His voice was trembly and his gut was rolling, but he was still angry. "I know he doesn't like it, but the truth is he surprised it out of me. I was just standing here, looking in the mirror to make sure my tie was straight, when he grabbed me and threw me against the wall. I smacked my head a pretty good one. Geez, Alan, I don't even know what I said."
Alan's eyes shifted back to Keaton. "Is that true?" Keaton dropped his own eyes. "I was mad," he said, and Alan supposed it was as close as a man like him could get to a spontaneous and undirected apology. He glanced back at Norris to see if the deputy understood this. It looked as if maybe Norris did. That was good. It was a long step toward defusing this nasty little stink bomb. Alan relaxed a little. "Can we consider this incident closed?" he asked both men. "Just kind of chalk it up to experience and go on from there?"
"All right by me," Norris said after a moment.
Alan was touched. Norris was scrawny. He had a habit of leaving half-full cans of Jolt and Knee-High in the cruisers he used, and his reports were horrors, but he had yards of heart. He was backing down, but not because he was afraid of Keaton. If the burly head selectman thought that was it, he was making a very bad mistake. "I'm sorry I called you Buster," Norris said. He wasn't, not a bit. But it didn't hurt to say he was. He supposed. Alan looked at the heavy-set man in the loud sport coat and open-necked golfer shirt. "Danforth?" "All right." "It never happened," Keaton said. He spoke in a tone of overblown magnanimity, and Alan felt a familiar wave of dislike wash over him. A voice buried somewhere deep in his mind, the primitive crocodile voice of the subconscious, spoke up briefly but clearly. "Why don't you have a heart attack, Buster? Why don't you do us all a favor and die?" "All right," he said. "Good deal. If," Keaton said, raising one finger. Alan raised his eyebrows. "If? If we can do something about this ticket." He held it out toward Alan, tweezed between two fingers, as if it were a rag which had been used to clean up some dubious spill. Alan sighed. "Come on in the office, Danforth. We'll talk about it." He looked at Norris. "You've got the duty, right?"
"Right," Norris said.
His stomach was still in a ball. His good feelings were gone, probably for the rest of the day, and it was that fat pig's fault, and Alan was going to forgive the ticket. He understood it, politics, but that didn't mean he had to like it. "Do you want to hang around?" Alan asked. It was as close as he could come to asking, "Do you need to talk this out?" with Keaton standing right there and glowering at both of them. "No," Norris said. "Places to go and things to do. Talk to you later, Alan." He left the men's room, brushing past Keaton without a glance, and although Norris did not know it, Keaton restrained with a great, almost heroic effort, an irrational but mighty urge to plant a foot in his ass to help him on his way. Alan made a business of checking his own reflection in the mirror, giving Norris time to make a clean getaway, while Keaton stood by the door, watching him impatiently. Then Alan pushed out into the bullpen area again, with Keaton at his heels. A small, dapper man in a cream-colored suit was sitting in one of the two chairs outside the door to his office, ostentatiously reading a large, leather-bound book which could only have been a Bible.
Alan's heart sank. He had been fairly sure nothing else too unpleasant could happen this morning. It would be noon in only 2 or 3 minutes, so the idea seemed a reasonable one. But he had been wrong. The Reverend William Rose closed his Bible, the binding of which almost matched his suit, and bounced to his feet. "Chief of Pangborn," he said. The Reverend Rose was one of those deep-thicket Baptists who begin to twist the tails of their words when they are emotionally cranked up. "May I please speak to you?" "Give me 5 minutes, please, Reverend Rose. I have a matter to attend to." "This is extremely important." "I bet," Alan thought. "So is this. 5 minutes." He opened the door and ushered Keaton into his office before the Reverend Willie, as Father Brigham liked to call him, could say anything else. "It'll be about casino night," Keaton said after Alan had closed the office door. "You mark my words. Father John Brigham is a bull-headed Irishman, but I'll take him over that fella any time. Rose is an incredibly arrogant prick." "There goes the pot, calling the kettle black," Alan thought. "Have a seat, Danforth." Keaton did. Alan went around his desk, held the parking ticket up, and tore it into small fragments. These he tossed into the wastebasket. "There. Okay?" "Okay," Keaton said, and moved to rise. "No, sit down a moment longer." Keaton's bushy eyebrows drew together below his high pink forehead in a thundercloud. "Please," Alan added. He dropped into his own swivel chair. His hands came together and tried to make a blackbird. Alan caught them at it and folded them firmly together on the blotter. "We're having an appropriations committee meeting next week dealing with budgetary matters for town meeting in February," Alan began. "Damn right," Keaton rumbled. "And that's a political thing," Alan went on. "I recognize it, and you recognize it. I just tore up a perfectly valid parking ticket because of a political consideration." Keaton smiled a little. "You've been in town long enough to know how things work, Alan. One hand washes the other." Alan shifted in his chair. It made its little creakings and squeakings, sounds he sometimes heard in his dreams after long, hard days, the kind of day this one was turning out to be. "Yes," he said, "one hand washes the other, but only for so long." The eyebrows drew together again. "What does that mean?" "It means there's a place, even in small towns, where politics have to end. You need to remember that I'm not an appointed official. The selectmen may control the purse strings, but the voters elect me. And what they elect me to do is protect them, and to preserve and uphold the law. I took the oath, and I try to hold to it." "Are you threatening me? Because if you are..." Just then the mill whistle went off. It was muted in here, but Danforth Keaton still jumped, as if he had been stung by a wasp. His eyes widened momentarily, and his hands clamped down to white claws on the arms of his chair. Alan felt that puzzlement again. He's as skittish as a mare in heat. What the hell's wrong with him? For the first time, he found himself wondering if maybe Mr. Danforth Keaton, who had been Castle Rock's head selectman since long before Alan himself ever heard of the place, had been up to something that was not strictly kosher. "I'm not threatening you," he said. Keaton was beginning to relax again, but warily, as if he were afraid the mill whistle might go off again, just to goose him. "That's good, because it isn't just a question of purse strings, Sheriff Pangborn. The Board of Selectmen, along with the 3 county commissioners, holds right of approval over the hiring and the firing of sheriff's deputies, among many other rights of approval I'm sure you know about. That's just a rubber stamp." "So it always has been," Keaton agreed. From his inside pocket, he produced a Roy Tan cigar. He pulled it between his fingers, making the cellophane crackle. "That doesn't mean it has to stay that way." Now who is threatening whom, Alan thought, but did not say. Instead, he leaned back in his chair and looked at Keaton. Keaton met his eyes for a few seconds, then dropped his gaze to the cigar and began picking at the wrapper. "The next time you park in the handicap space, I'm going to ticket you myself, and that citation will stand," Alan said. "And if you ever lay your hands on one of my deputies again, I'll book you on a charge of 3rd-degree assault. That will happen no matter how many so-called rights of approval the selectmen hold, because politics only stretches so far with me. Do you understand?" Keaton looked down at the cigar for a long moment, as if meditating. When he looked up at Alan again, his eyes had turned to small, hard flints. "If you want to find out just how hard my ass is, Sheriff Pangborn, you go on pushing me." There was anger written on Keaton's face, yes, most assuredly, but Alan thought there was something else written there as well. He thought it was fear. Did he see that? Smell it? He didn't know, and it didn't matter. But what Keaton was afraid of, that might matter. That might matter a lot. Do you understand? He repeated. Yes, Keaton said. He stripped the cellophane from his cigar with a sudden hard gesture and dropped it on the floor. He stuck the cigar in his mouth and spoke around it. Do you understand me? The chair creaked and croaked as Alan rocked forward again. He looked at Keaton earnestly. I understand what you're saying, but I sure as hell don't understand how you're acting, Danforth. We've never been best buddies, you and I, that's for sure, Keaton said, and bit off the end of his cigar. For a moment, Alan thought that was going to end up on the floor, too, and he was prepared to let it go if it did, politics. But Keaton spat it into the palm of his hand and then deposited it in the clean ashtray on the desk. It sat there like a small dog turd. But we've always had a pretty good working relationship. Now this. Is there something wrong? If there is, and I can help. Nothing is wrong, Keaton said, rising abruptly. He was angry again, more than just angry. Alan could almost see steam coming out of his ears. It's just that I'm so tired of this persecution. It was the second time he had used the word. Alan found it an odd word, an unsettling word. In fact, he found this whole conversation unsettling. Well, you know where I am, Alan said. God, yes, Keaton said and went to the door. And please, Danforth, remember about the handicap space. Fuck the handicap space, Keaton said and slammed out. Alan sat behind his desk and looked at the closed door for a long time, a troubled expression on his face. Then he went around the desk, picked up the crumpled cellophane cylinder lying on the floor, dropped it into the wastebasket, and went to the door to invite Steamboat Willie in. Mr. Keaton looked rather upset, Rose said. He seated himself carefully in the chair the head selectman had just vacated, looked with distaste at the cigar end sitting in the ashtray, and then placed his white Bible carefully in the center of his ungenerous lap. Lots of appropriations meetings in the next month or so, Alan said vaguely. I'm sure it's a strain for all the selectmen. Yes, Reverend Rose agreed. For Jesus told us, render unto Caesar those things which are Caesar's, and render unto God those things which are a God's. Uh-huh, Alan said. He suddenly wished he had a cigarette, something like a Lucky or a Pall Mall that was absolutely stuffed with tar and nicotine. What can I render unto you this afternoon, Reverend Rose? He was horrified to realize he had just come extremely close to calling the man Reverend Willie. Rose took off his round, rimless spectacles, polished them, and then settled them back in place, hiding the two small red spots high up on his nose. His black hair, plastered in place with some sort of hair potion Alan could smell but not identify, gleamed in the light of the fluorescent grid set into the ceiling. It's about the abomination Father John Brigham chooses to call a casino night, the Reverend Rose announced at last. If you recall, Chief Pangborn, I came to you not long after I had first heard of this dreadful idea to demand that you refuse to sanction such an event in the name of a decency. Reverend Rose, if you'll recall, Rose held up one hand imperiously and dipped the other into his jacket pocket. He came out with a pamphlet, which was almost the size of a paperback book. It was, Alan saw with a sinking heart, but no real surprise, the abridged version of the State of Maine's Code of Laws. I am now a come again, Reverend Rose said in ringing tones, to demand that you forbid this event not only in the name of a decency, but in the name of the law. Reverend Rose, this is Section 24, Subsection 9, Paragraph 2 of the Maine State Code of Laws, Reverend Rose overrode him. His cheeks now flared with color, and Alan realized that the only thing he'd managed to do in the last few minutes was to swap one crazy for another. Except to where noted, Reverend Rose read, his voice now taking on the pulpit chant with which his mostly adoring congregation was so familiar. Games of a chance, as a previously defined in the Section 23 of the Code, where wagers of a money are induced as a condition of a play, shall be deemed illegal. He snapped the code closed and looked at Alan. His eyes were blazing. Shall be deemed illegal, he cried. Alan felt a brief urge to throw his arms in the air and yell, "Praise the Jesus!" When it had passed, he said, "I'm aware of those sections of the code which pertain to gambling, Reverend Rose. I looked them up after your earlier visit to me, and I showed them to Albert Martin, who does a lot of the town's legal work. His opinion was that Section 23 does not apply to such functions as casino night." He paused, then added, "I have to tell you that was my opinion as well."
"Impossible!" Rose spat. "They propose to turn the House of the Lord into a gambler's lair, and you tell me that is illegal?"
"It's every bit as legal as the bingo games that have been going on at the Daughters of Isabella Hall since 1931.
"This is a not bingo. This is a roulette. This is a playing cards for money. This is..."
Reverend Rose's voice trembled.
"Dice."
Alan caught his hands, trying to make another bird, and this time he locked them together on the desk blotter. I had Albert write a letter of inquiry to Jim Tierney, the state's attorney general. The answer was the same. "I'm sorry, Reverend Rose. I know it offends you. Me, I've got a thing about kids on skateboards. I'd outlaw them if I could, but I can't. In a democracy, we sometimes have to put up with things we don't like or approve of."
"But this is a gambling,"
Reverend Rose said, and there was real anguish in his voice.
"This is a gambling for a money. How can such a thing be legal when the code specifically says..."
"The way they do it, it's really not gambling for money. Each participant pays a donation at the door. In return, the participant is given an equal amount of play money. At the end of the night, a number of prizes, not money, but prizes, are auctioned off. A VCR, a toaster oven, a dirt devil, a set of china, things like that." And some dancing interior imp made him add, "I believe the initial donation